Senate Education Committee will come to order. We have a full schedule of testifiers today. I think there's 32 and counting. And I think everybody wants to be able to get out before 5 o'clock. So I think calculating that, I would urge just about everyone here, would like to speak. So can I strongly urge you to be as concise as possible in making your point so that we can get everybody an opportunity to express their view. I appreciate all of you being here and ready to offer your constructive views on the subject. And so we, without further ado, let's begin. And if you've seen the agenda, we're going to try to move through the articles as it relates to the areas of interest that you have. So the first on the agenda is Mr. Toburin? Matt Toburin from the SEIU? Is there such a person here? Am I mangling your name?
Pretty close. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matt Toburin.
Okay, thank you.
And I represent SEIU Local 284, which is the Union of Public School Support Staff. And I apologize for seeming unprepared. We were just grabbing the agenda and didn't realize that we were first on the docket.
Madam Chair, could you just move that microphone right in close in front of you? Thank you.
Is this better? Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, members, I'd just like to start off by thanking the committee for the hard work that you have done this session, your commitment to children, your commitment to education, and protecting the educational system we have in this state. We as an organization have a couple concerns with this bill as it relates to the public employee labor relations law and some of the dramatic changes to that effect. But before I go talk too much in detail about that, I want to introduce one of our SEIU members, Valerie Ralstead.
Hi, I'm Valerie Ralstead. I'm a mother of three. I also work in Columbia Heights School District as a special ed paraprofessional in an EBD Level 3 program. And I'm here to talk about the history of, we were the last group in my district to organize, and our first few contracts were very difficult to negotiate. But this last go-around, we both knew, the school district and my paraprofessional unit, knew that dollars were tight for our school district, and that we knew that, you know, monies weren't going to be there necessarily, but we were willing to go in and work out a compromise, and we didn't get much. We got things changed in our contract that were word effective, but as far as salaries, increases, or any of that, we knew that was not going to happen because districts have been, school budgets have been hit hard. And we came to the table thinking, you know, we can compromise, we can work together. And I think that's where, you know, we should be allowed to do that at the table. We're taxpayers in the community ourselves, so we know that it's difficult. But still, we are workers, too, and we still have to put food on the table for our families. I still have to pay the school sports fees and whatever fees that I have to pay for the schools for my child to participate. So I still need to make a living. So somewhere along the line, we have to still have the opportunity to do that.
And Madam Chair, I would just like to add that Valerie is a fantastic example of how they went into negotiations this summer. The superintendent said, you know, we value the work you do. You're an integral part of the school, but we are broke. And the employees said, we understand, and they took freezes for the contract cycle, and we settled four different employee group contracts in 2 days, no raises, and the And the group said, you know, we would be willing to take cuts in our pay if you would stop laying off employees because we are all, you know, sacrificing to get the job done. So with that, I just would like to say the way our Public Employee Labor Relations Act works, it's been working. It's in the interest of the public and in giving a voice to the employees who are there to do the job because they love the children, not to make money, and that there's been a lot of talk about the right to strike. None of our members want to strike, have any desire to strike, would ever want to strike, but having the right to strike there keeps us from ever having to strike. That having the right there puts the sides together for a harmonious relationship between the employers and the employees and is able to get things settled and worked out well. So with that, Madam Chair, members, I want to thank you for your time and urge you to reconsider some of the more extreme aspects of changing the Public Employee Labor Relations Law. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do we need to
Moving to Article 2, Jerry Schoenfeld.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I work with the Minnesota Association of Ag Educators, but more broadly I'm working here with All Career and Technical Education. And I wanted to thank you for the opportunity that you've given us during the session, spend a couple of days with you talking about career and technical education. I think what you've got in the bill is certainly consistent with the direction we were attempting to go, and it's consistent with expanding the definition, for instance, of career and technical education to include 9th through 12th rather than 10th through 12th. Which is consistent with the Department of Education's definition. I think what the bill helps us to do is to integrate academic and technical courses. Contextual learning within our courses brings relevance to students, and we think that it helps provide balance. What you have in the bill will help to provide balance between the science, the math, technical portions, and engineering portions under STEM as such, to bring all of those things together. We believe it helps us keep students in schools. During our discussion earlier, the couple of days that we had before you, Dr. Stone had talked about how career and technical education helps to keep students in schools, helps them to provide them with improved middle skills, the kinds of skills that our employees in our economy that don't necessarily get exported to other types of countries, such as low-skilled or, in some cases, high-skilled jobs. It also provides with three major challenges in the education system. We think it helps in this area, the changes you've made, and those are of engagements with the idea of attending and completing school. Not all students are in the straight academic performance. Secondly, with regard to achievement in both academic and technical skills. And third, to transition to provide for post-secondary education without remediation. It provides personal returns for the individuals, and we believe it's a good investment by the educational system. And so with that, Madam Chair, we appreciate the provisions that presently are in the bill and hope you will maintain them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there? I failed to offer you an opportunity to question our last witnesses or to ask each one of you at the table to sign in as you testify. So are there any questions of our previous testifiers or of Mr. Schoenfeld? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for your testimony. Jean O'Connell from the St. Paul Public School Board.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome.
Thank you for letting us be here. I'm here today as the Vice Chair of the St. Paul Public School Board, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm here today to urge you to reconsider the freezing of compensatory and special ed revenue and eliminating integration revenue in fiscal year 2013. I understand that many of you come from districts that receive less per pupil revenue than St. Paul. Based on the most recent school profiles posted on the MDE website in July, St. Paul's total general fund expenditures totaled $12,836 per ADM. So it would make sense to ask, why does it cost more on average to educate a student in St. Paul than in some other districts in the state? To answer that, it's important to remember what that number represents. In addition to what we send to our own schools for K-12 education, this amount also includes transportation for nearly 2,400 private school students, as well as providing special education and health services to the private school students in our city who need them. Over $8.3 million in 2009-10 was paid to other districts, charter schools, correctional facilities, residential facilities, private agencies, and other states to cover tuition for regular ed and special ed students. This is growing by over $1 million a year. Although we would not see an inflationary increase in our revenue, we would continue to pay for the required special ed services of private school and charter school students. We have to cover the difference by taking funds from other programs in our district, which is essentially a cut to our general fund. Services and transportation for over 2,000 highly mobile and homeless children come out of our general fund. High-quality programming for nearly 1,400 pre-kindergartners who are primarily low-income, ELL, or special ed. As you well know, research says that pays returns many times over. All-day kindergarten is funded with our integration and compensatory dollars. And again, as many of you know, most of our students come to school not ready for kindergarten. We also pay for continued educational services to thousands of students until they turn 21. These are primarily special ed students or newcomers to our country who arrive as secondary students. Senator Stump's committee heard our LEAP Academy students beg for an opportunity to stay in school past the age of 21 so they could earn their high school diploma and go to college. In just the last year and a half, we've had over 1,500 new Karen students enroll in the district. They are the most recent of a steady wave of refugees that we have adapted to serve in the St. Paul schools. We spend over $12 million beyond what the state funds each year to ensure that English language learners meet standards. And we've been recognized nationally for closing the gap between English language learner and non-English language learner students. This has been an incredible investment for both us and the state. We also have large numbers of special ed students at every level of disability, and with many in self-contained or specialized classrooms and programs. It wasn't long ago that these students were in state hospitals or in other residential facilities, and now we are serving them daily in our schools. It's not uncommon to spend $40,000 a year on each disabled child, which is simply the cost of serving those students under federal and state guidelines. In the same report, Metro Deaf spent over $42,800 per ADM and Fraser Academy over $35,200 as a comparison. Our special ed cross subsidy exceeds $38 million, which means that we take $38 million from our general fund each year to cover the cost of unfunded federal and state mandates for special ed. I know this committee has heard from a number of principals in our schools, both elementary and secondary, where our diverse students are making gains and our dedicated staff are closing the achievement gap. As you may have been told, all the principals who came to your committee lead schools that have at least 80% of students from low-income families, many of whom are highly mobile or homeless, some with significant refugee populations. And they are all successful in working with these students. We still have a long way to go, but taking resources away from these schools will set us back further. Two of those schools have been recognized by the Minnesota Business Partnership as well as nationally for beating the odds, Dayton's Bluff and Farnsworth. You also heard from Mike McCullough from Washington Secondary and Catherine Rich from Phelan Lake Elementary, whose schools serve large numbers of refugee students. They do it well thanks to the state's investment in integration and comp ed aid. Phelan Lake has a language academy where an all-day kindergarten and four sections of first graders who are all new to the country and have little or no English. Phelan Lake has made gains because they have additionally hired trained teachers and bilingual paraprofessionals who work together to focus on literacy with these students on an individual basis. This is an incredibly successful strategy for reading by third grade. I want to thank this committee and the chair in particular for your commitment to ensuring that all of our students can read by third grade. However, as the bill is currently written, the net impact is a reduction in resources for students that are successful in teaching for schools that are successful in teaching students to read, not just by third grade, but at all ages, because they don't always come to us by third grade. Like you, our superintendent and those on the Board of Education have made some very tough decisions recently to balance our budget and to expand successful models. We've closed underperforming schools, merged programs to save resources, and we're replicating or expanding successful programs like those you heard about at Farnsworth and Dayton's Bluff. We've instituted professional learning communities where our teachers use data to improve their instruction based on the students' results. And we're more carefully managing instructional strategies at schools that are not making necessary progress. We've recently approved our Strong Schools, Strong Communities strategic plan. And over the next 3 years, we're realigning our programming and transportation to cut expenses to respond to our existing structural deficit while still providing community schools, regional and citywide magnets to ensure continued parental choice and integration. The elimination of our integration funding in fiscal year 13 of nearly $20 million derails our recently adopted plan. From 2006 to our current projection for fiscal year 2012, we've had to cover $95.4 million in cumulative general fund shortfall. Before this omnibus bill, we already had projected the need to reduce our budget by $19 million for next year. We appreciate the formula increase holding us harmless for this coming year and including Senator Harrington's bill for full school zones. However, when we add up all of the budget changes, it undercuts our work to refocus our choice system, raise accountability across the district, and close the achievement gap for all our students. We've seen success in our schools, and we recognize the value that the state has made investing in our children. We look forward to continued discussions with you to ensure a quality education program for all students in our state, and again would extend our invitation to each one of you to visit our schools anytime it's convenient for you. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? Senator Regan?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair O'Connell. I commend the district on the rollout of its strategic plan. You've said the proposal that we have would undercut that. It would significantly impact your effort to close the achievement gap. I also recognize you're not a politician. You have a distinguished career from 3M. Mm-hmm. And I'd like you to amplify a little more as to how this will curtail your efforts to close the achievement gap, because I believe that is our highest priority.
Okay. Well, as Senator Wigger... Excuse me, Chair.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
That's right.
As Senator Wigger mentioned, I worked at 3M in an executive capacity for many years before retiring and then running for school board in St. Paul. So I understand how difficult what you're trying to do here on a statewide level is in terms of making decisions and not necessarily understanding the impact in each individual area. But St. Paul Schools has done, I think, a particularly good job of looking at administrative costs over the years. We're one of the lowest percent administration costs in the entire state, 3%. And what this integration funding change will do for us is it truly undercuts our ability to provide transportation to a number of students. And as I mentioned earlier, we have 2,000 homeless students. And one of the ways that we're trying to make sure that those students achieve as well as others is to make sure that they have consistent schools. So they are placed in magnet schools so that regardless of where home is tonight, that they will have transportation to that same school so that they're with the same students every day and the same teachers. And that makes a huge difference in their ability to succeed. But in general, we're very concerned that by reducing our compensatory and integration funding, that we will no longer have that breathing room to bring the right specialists in to work with our special needs students, of whom those are not just our special ed students, but we have ELL learners. 40% of our students are English learners. We have 70% of our students are low income and in need of special services on a regular basis. So thank you, Senator Wicker.
Thank you.
Ms. O'Connell, what is your overall budget?
Our overall budget, including, our overall general fund budget is $426 million.
Does that include all your federal funds as well?
Yes, it does.
From all sources?
Yes.
And for your students, we probably have that number.
The general fund portion is 426. The overall budget is 623. So I'm not. Some of the federal funding would probably come under the fully financed portion.
Okay.
And I don't know that I have that number right in my head.
And you were already in process of making how much?
Last year we made $27 million in cuts. For the fiscal year going forward, we're looking at $19 million.
So you're going to have $19 million less revenue, or is that a cut from
anticipated
growth of revenue?
It is a combination of reduction in number of students longer term. We've seen a slight decline. We've seen a decline overall because of demographics in Ramsey County and in the city of St. Paul. But we are actually working a plan to increase our market share within the community. We currently serve 72% of the school-age students in St. Paul, and we're looking to increase that to the 75% level. That's one of our longer-term efforts to improve our ability to sustain the current education program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Moving on, Kathy Griebel, Minnesota School Integration Council. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Kathy Griebel. I'm representing the Minnesota School Integration Council and the East Metro Integration District. And I'm here to testify in strong opposition to this bill's elimination of integration efforts. This fall, the Minnesota School Integration Council, with the endorsement of the current Commissioner Alice Segrin, convened a task force to review the policy and address concerns raised by the 2005 Office of Legislative Auditors report. Following a comprehensive review of the current Minnesota desegregation rule and the Minnesota integration statute, the statewide task force developed recommendations in five key areas. Number one, clarify the purpose of integration policy. Two, establish and enforce accountability measures. Three, identify and support effective practices. Four, seek partnerships and encourage collaboration. And five, distribute resources to meet outcomes. In their study, the task force came to the following conclusions. Integration is a compelling interest of the state and is an essential tool in achieving equity and excellence. Despite the lack of clarity with the current rule, there are amazing results coming from the current program, whether it's increased student graduation rates or more better and increased participation in gifted and talented programs. Students and their communities are being positively impacted through this program. Significant changes are needed to prepare all students. As this committee notes, teaching kids to read is important. Additionally, preparing kids to live and work effectively in a diverse economy and workforce is critical. I urge you to include strong integration policy as a critical component of our statewide agenda focused on eliminating disparities and creating educational equity and opportunity for all Minnesota children. The task force recognizes that closing achievement gaps and creating inclusive learning environments is a very complex issue, which will require a comprehensive solution. Please amend, don't end the integration program. The task force recommendations promote a focus on results and require greater accountability for the use of integration revenue. clarify the outcomes of the program, identify measurable metrics, and distribute resources to meet outcomes. In the words of Justice Kennedy, this nation has a moral and ethical obligation to fulfill its historic commitment to creating an integrated society that ensures equal opportunity for all its children. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Ms. Grable? Thank you very much. Mark Robertson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thanks for letting me testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson.
My name is Mark Robertson, and I am representing Northwest Suburban Integration School District today, but in a broader sense, I'm representing the other two metro area integration school districts of EMID and WEMEP. Those three integration districts represent 300,000 students in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, and they represent over 30 districts. For Northwest specifically, we have 108,000 students with eight districts, including the largest district in the state in Alka-Hennepin, as well as one of the smaller metro school districts, Brooklyn Center. While each of the three integration districts take slightly different approaches on how they approach the DSAG rule, all of them are working for equity and access for students, and they are working to close achievement gaps, as you well know. What I would like to speak today is about the idea of achievement and some of the discussion that has occurred in lots of circles that the integration rule has not been effective. As you well know, just a few years ago, OLA had an audit report, and I can speak for what Northwest did with that. We sat down with that and said, you know, we can do things better. We need to collect data. We need to really fine-tune things and focus on the achievement gap just as much as we focus on things like cultural competency. So I want to highlight three things, and I also brought a folder full of data because I keep hearing around the circles that no one collects any data and we can't demonstrate any tangible results in closing achievement gaps. So let me speak first briefly about our magnet schools. We have a unique model. We have 15 magnet schools. We have seven more under development that will all be fully in place by the fall of 2012, assuming that we can continue our work. We have three themes that are high rigor. One is International Baccalaureate. One is the arts, and one is in the area of STEM. We are adding the seven new magnets because we have a lack of magnet seats for STEM. We turn away hundreds every year because they can't get into our STEM programs. And so what I want to speak about is this model is different, and it requires transportation. And I see that that's part of this bill, that transportation will be eliminated after this next fiscal year. It will destroy those magnet programs and what it is doing for kids that are underserved. These 15 magnet schools serve 11,500 students. 3,400 of those students in those magnets are choosing a school outside of their own attendance area. About 30% of those students are choosing schools outside their own attendance area. The majority of those students still are white, but 36% are students that are students of color. And the demographics are very varied on the north side, but our average is less than 25% in those north suburbs. So more students of color are accessing those high rigor programs than our white students. And it's been highly effective. I can tell you that two districts in particular, Fridley, where I was the superintendent previously, it turned the district around to move to a magnet model. When I walked in there were 2,350 students. Today there are 2,950 students, and they are talking about building programs. Brooklyn Center is a similar district that has struggled with enrollment and so on. They have over 800 students out of their 2,100 are open enrolled or in the magnet program coming into their district. They are attracting kids, they are high quality, they are high rigor, and they're getting the job done academically, and they're closing the gap. I'll give you two other examples. We have two schools in really challenging environments, and their AYP categories have been reduced in one school from 7 to 2 and the other 10 to 3 in the last 2 years. They're getting the job done in reaching student achievement goals at a higher level and closing achievement gaps. Let me highlight a second program. One program we've invested lots of energy in, that's JMNG, Jobs for Minnesota Graduates. It's a nationally affiliated program. We're the only ones in the state that do this. This targets the bottom 20th percentile of the classes, juniors and seniors in high school. The data that you'll see, if you look at that, is astounding. 43% of these students are on the verge of dropout or attending colleges. We have a graduation rate somewhere around 98% of the kids that are in this program, and they're experiencing a high level of success through the JAG program. The third program I'd like to mention that would this cut would be devastating for would be the AVID students. That targets the middle 50 percentile. Over half of the students participating in AVID in our district are students of color. 100% take the ACT. We have 2 years of data on this. And 100% have applied to colleges and been accepted. And so to say if there's no data available, we have data, and we are working on developing more data around this. But I want to encourage you to not use the data argument to say that the integration rule has not served students effectively, because it has in our instance. I have a summary available for you if you'd like to look at that. And we know we need to get better. We continue to work on that. But we would be devastated if the integration funding source were taken away, and it would be a double whammy if the transportation were taken away the following year.
Thank you. Is the your data available in what fashion? Is it connected into the state data system?
No. I have it right here. Part of the trick of that, Madam Chair, is that, you know, when the OLA report came out, we started looking at data, but I'm not sure what people want. Do you want graduation rates? Do you want MCA scores? Do you want NWA scores? You know, and so it is tied in directly, but it needs to be extracted and put into a reasonable fashion and so on. So that could be done, but nobody has done that at a state level to say this is how we want it reported and how we want it extracted and pulled in. So I think what's happening in a number of cases is that people are keeping individual, you know, data in their own district, collaboratives around the state. We have decided to start collecting that as a 8-district collaborative, and we're in the process of putting that all together. But what I collected was the things that we know that we already have in place, and some of the data is incredibly compelling. When you can take kids that are struggling at the bottom of their classes and not just get them through high school, but get them to access post-secondary things. So
if you could organize that data, you've made some interesting claims in terms of closing the achievement gap, how that is measured. There should be a graphic way of displaying what you've been able to do in relation to the categories of students that reflect that gap. I think that would be helpful to have. I don't know that I've ever seen anything that does present that in a way that gives evidence to the results that you claim, and I think that's important. It's important for you as well as for us.
Well, Madam Chair, I will leave this, and anybody is free. And I think you, in 5 pages or less, you can look and say, "Wow, there are some great things." And you know, we are a staff of 8, okay, and so we will do that, and we will put it in, you know, charts and graphs to make it pretty even more compelling for you. But I just want to assure you that there is information there. We have been working on the achievement gap specifically and pointedly, and we've actually eliminated some programs that we said those don't directly relate to student achievement, and so we're not going to do that.
Can you also link that to your budget and your sources of revenue?
We have
so that there's a comparability to other either school districts or schools.
We can do that, Madam Chair. In the new with the new integration budget requirements that was sent out by MDE this year, one of the things that the new requirements that they required that really hadn't been done in the past, we need to make direct links between money spent and what the intended outcome is. And so it's one more step to just say this was the actual outcome that we received for the dollars that we spent.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there other questions that you have of Mr. Robertson? Okay. Senator Weaver.
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair and Mr. Robertson, that's very impressive. 100% of the students are going to college?
We have 8 years Mr. of JAG tracking, and the JAG data is 43%, which is the bottom quartile. But the AVID, it's a newer program for us. We have 2 years of data that we've tracked because it's fresh. We didn't get going on this till about 3 years ago, and it starts. You can start it in the middle school and work it through the high school. But the data, I did not bring that specific spreadsheet. I brought a summary of that sheet, but I can show you that from the schools, and I can show you what schools those students are attending to. So it's good information to have.
Madam Chair, I would find that helpful, and if you have it further broken down as to whether in testing, you would probably have those ACT scores. You don't necessarily have to take ACT for admission, but if you have data on how many were actually college ready, not needing remedial. But congratulations on the great participation to the next level.
Madam Chair, part of this discussion is exactly, if we're going to measure things on a statewide basis, it helps with saying, I'm starting from a 10,000 foot level drilling down, and it's helpful to say this is exactly what we'd like, and we would like to see those comparisons because then we can extract that data. It takes some time, but if you know what you're targeting when you start the game, it's a lot easier to than to try to fill in the blanks afterwards. So.
Thank you very much. Jill Schultz from Eden Prairie. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak to you this afternoon. My name is Jill Schultz, and I am here representing the West Metro Education Program. And I'm here to give a perspective on integration revenue and how those dollars spent through WEMEP affect education. But before I do that, I just want to briefly tell you a little bit about myself. 10 years ago, I was elected to the Eden Prairie School Board, and I served there for 8 years. I also served on the WEMEP School Board for 5 of those 8 years. But for the past 2 years, I've been working for the West Metro Education Program. I am not an educator. I am working there because I believe in the work. And the work is basically, my job at WEMEP is to organize and manage the cultural collaborative. This is a booklet that shows all of the staff development courses that are offered by the West Metro Education Program. By being a member of WEMEP, district staff can take these courses basically for free, and we pay for their subs. The courses are phenomenal. We bring in speakers from all over the nation who really talk about innovation and progressive strategies, pedagogies, tools, essentially, for educators to use in closing the achievement gap. But it's more than that. It's about integrating our schools, and it's not just putting students of different races next to each other. Integration is about relationships and removing ignorance and gaining a broader understanding of multiple perspectives and being able to use that in the classroom to prepare all students to be productive and comfortable working in any cultural environment. It's about all students belonging. And you're considering changes to the laws with regard to integration revenue, and I'm here to tell you that there's really good work being done through WEMEP in the cultural collaborative. I personally just have witnessed so many opportunities where teachers engaged in this work. Today I was at a workshop where they have these aha moments. They're speaking very courageously in a safe place about race and racial predictability. What does that mean for them as a teacher? What kind of assumptions are they holding? What do they need to let go of? And how do they really do this work in a meaningful way? How do they get students to be engaged in the classroom? And that all leads to closing the achievement gap, and it actually raises achievement for all students. I know there's been a lot of talk about data, and as I mentioned, I'm not an educator. I'm a lawyer. I'm a citizen. I have two high school students. I believe in this work. I would love to be able to gather data from what I see in doing this work and give it to you, but it's really about testimony in the actual experiences that teachers have. I'll give you one example of something that increases engagement for a student in a personal experience I had being on the Eden Prairie School Board when we had engagement with a parent group, and we talked about basically the achievement data and showed our citizens the gap. I was speaking with another white parent who made the comment that, well, those kids' parents don't care about education. And I asked her to say, well, why are you saying that? Well, basically because they don't come to conferences, they're never, you never see them. And I said, well, have you ever met any parent that doesn't care about their child's education? And she said, no. I said, so why would you assume that somebody wouldn't care about their child's education based on the color of their skin? And I was able to have that conversation in a courageous and safe way with her because of the training that's being offered in the Cultural Collaborative, because I myself had gone through some of the training with teachers where you really do a self-examination of your own assumptions around race, and you find ways to be able to talk about that safely and productively so that you can move on and get the work done. So I do believe in accountability. I do believe that we have to be responsible with our dollars. But I'll give one more example in Eden Prairie. Forest Hills is an elementary school that has changed rapidly with an influx of Somali immigrants and students of color. Several years ago, I visited that school and saw how they were closing the achievement gap with specific strategies used that they learned through the WEMEP Cultural Collaborative and the National Urban Alliance. These teachers had done a self-assessment of their own assumptions and really, really, really believed that all students could achieve and drew those students in to being fully engaged in their classroom with high standards. And then they used those strategies and continually assessed what was working on a weekly basis. So in the classroom, it's a lot easier to see than on a spreadsheet that's regional as far as a district or even more a larger region than that. And what I noticed also was notable was that the scores for the white students in this school that was predominantly students of color were higher than the scores in the Eden Prairie schools where the race was predominantly white. So several points I need to make. There is success out there. This is hard work. It is courageous work. There's wonderful work being done by teachers. And at the end of the day, it's all about preparing all students for success. So I sympathize with your plight in handling the budget and really examining where those dollars go. And as a taxpayer, I honor that. And I appreciate your hard work. But I ask that you please consider that we need to have high expectations for all kids. We need to have the funds to be able to teach them well. And we need to have even higher standards for the educators. So we need to hold the paid professionals who educate these students to high standards by preserving integration revenue and allowing WEMEP staff development to continue and also to promote regional collaboration for success for all. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schultz. I have visited Forest Hills Elementary Wonderful. School and spoke to teachers in their preparation for particularly the focus on reading. And for those of you that were here and saw that little four-minute video, and you saw a teacher that was talking about his experience in the reading, that's Mike Savage, and he is one of the ones that's been driving that improvement and change in the in that Forest Hills school, and I believe, probably, hopefully, it'll spread to other buildings as they need it. But that's become a high-performing school, I believe.
Yes, it is.
That focus on literacy proficiency has been a key element of that.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Pat Gleason from the Wayzata School Board. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Senator Olson, members of the committee. My name is Pat Gleason. I may not look like it, but I have been around for a very long time on the Wayzata School Board, on the WEMEP Joint Powers Board. I was on the WEMEP Joint Wayzata, came to the WEMEP Association in the mid-90s, and became then part of the settlement of the lawsuit, the NAACP versus the state of Minnesota lawsuit. And we now have somewhere in excess of 200 students in Wayzata from North Minneapolis, and we have them across all grade levels. I am here today to speak against the integration portion of this omnibus education bill, because if the transportation for those students goes away, what will happen? In 2013, we will still have 200 students from North Minneapolis who will have no way to get to our schools. I think we're making a big difference in their lives, and I would like for them to be able to continue. We have data that shows the longer that these students are with us, the higher their achievement. We also have students from Wayzata who go to the magnet schools, the WEMEP magnet schools, Fair School, downtown, and in Crystal. Those students would have no way to get there also. The WEMEP consortium, which has been, I think, extremely successful in what Jill talked about earlier in providing professional development for teachers in all of our districts, has shown that these kinds of conversations have made a difference. Wayzata has significantly closed our achievement gap over the last few years. And to particularly pin it to any one thing is very difficult, but NUA strategies, courageous conversation, equity work, all of the things that have happened, I think, are what are showing that particular gap closing. I don't believe that actually just eliminating the DSEG rule, eliminating integration revenue is really going to solve the problem. I do understand the need for reform. I just wish that we had some way to do it in a thoughtful manner as opposed to amputating the entire process. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gleason. Are there questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Senator Wiegert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Gleason, for the 200 students, I think you said 200, mm-hmm. Do you have any data showing on specifically how the achievement gap has closed for that group?
I don't today, but I can Gleason? Get that for you. We do have data talking about students and how the students of color, in particular the students from Minneapolis, have a smaller achievement gap than even some of our residential students of color, the longer we keep them, if we get them as elementary students and they don't lose them to some sort of mobility issue, then the better they do. So I can actually send that to you. I'll have actually somebody who knows how to do that send that to you today
Thank
or
you.
Tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gleason. Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, Ms. Gleason, could you tell us the age breakout of those 200 students approximately? Just, you know, elementary school, junior high school.
Right. Senator Olson, Senator Bonner, it's a fairly, we don't have very many kindergarten students, but we do have probably predominantly elementary and middle school students. It's fairly level. We have high school students are the highest mobility students that we see. We don't see a lot of mobility in our elementary and middle school population. So, high school students do have a tendency to sometimes come and go, but stability is pretty constant through the rest of the grade levels.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Maria Johnson and Denny Chang from the Bloomington Schools. And I would encourage you to please to sign in if it remind you to sign in as you testify.
Thank you for having me, Madam Chair, Senators.
This is Maria.
Everyone in attendance. Yes, my name is Mariah Johnson.
Mariah.
Yes, ma'am. I am speaking from the point of a product of integration funds and now a mentor of those who benefit from integration funds. I was the very first mentoring group supported by integration dollars back when I was in the fifth grade. I have achieved so much because of it, and that's why I am now back to become a mentor, because I know what the programming can do. Because of the programming, I'm now in school for post-secondary education. Not only does the programs funded by integration dollars help in school achievement, but in life achievement. It gives the student resources they wouldn't normally have. And I realize that you do not see the faces of the children that are often left behind, but my face could have been one of them if not for the funding and if not for the program. These students are from all walks of life, but honestly, most of these students look like me. They're the minorities. So to rid districts of integration funding is to say that the staff, the community, and most importantly, we're telling the kids that we don't care about integration and we don't care about them. And you may not feel the impact of the achievement gap, but I would like you to know that integration dollars have helped many students remain in class, graduate from high school, enroll in college, and help some become first-class citizens. The essence of education is to give all students an equal and quality education and to promote the tolerance of all people. So by cutting integration dollars, we're opening up the door to ignorance and intolerance and setting us back hundreds of years. I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank you, what's called Madam Chair and the Senators. I'm sorry for my look. I came out of class. My name is Denny Chang, and I'm a current freshman in college. I've been with Bloomington Office of Education Equity since the sixth grade. I cannot express how much the program has helped me all the way through my high school years and my middle school years. The programs they provided me gave me a voice in life, and most importantly, a focus. Going into senior year, you know, the typical senior going in, not knowing what you want to do, college is next year, you're excited. Going through this program they provided me gave me a voice and gave me a power that I want to be a leader when I'm older. Maybe one of the positions, maybe being one of you guys when I'm older, I have a direction in my life. Being an Asian Minnesotan and going through the Bloomington Public School System, I never once saw a student, a mentor, teacher of color. I always had pure white teachers. But joining the program they provided me in sixth grade opened doors that, you know, teachers are of color. I never knew that before. Growing up Chinese, I thought teachers in America, you know, they're all the typical white cookie cutter teachers, but then having a mentor that was Asian really spoke out to me that maybe I could be one of those teachers that could change a life. Office of Education Equity has really provided me everything that I never really knew I needed. It gave me a foundation of school, going to college, and being a better person socially. I found a place where I can mature mentally and academically by going through different programs and events that they provided me. My advisors surrounded me with environments that broadened my horizons academically and socially. They pushed me to go to college. Senior year, my advisor was always checking on my grades, telling me, you know, you're not doing so great in math, you need to push this up. I feel if you cut the bill and you cut the funding, it will send back Minnesota hundreds of years of civil rights that people of color fought for. Removing funding for integration is basically giving up on students of color, not giving us the chance, and giving us respect that we all deserve. And I just guys thank you for your time. Thank you for listening for my story.
Thank you very much. We were just noting that the Bloomington Schools aid goes up each of the 2 years. Would Bloomington stop doing what they're doing, even though they're getting more revenue than they are now?
I would actually like to direct all questions to my director, Ms. Dina Wade-Ardley.
What's the question again?
Why don't you have a chair and introduce yourself, please, for the record?
I am Dina Wade-Ardley. I am the director of educational equity for Bloomington Public Schools.
Thank you. Runs in terms of the impact of the changes in the formula show Bloomington Schools increasing each of the next 2 years. So I'm wondering, would why would Bloomington stop doing what they're doing now?
They would stop some of the some of the activities that we provide.
Why?
But they don't have the funding.
Well, they'll be getting more money each.
I understand. I was at a budgeting meeting yesterday that although the formula is staying, we're holding still, we're getting a little bit more money, it's not enough to make a difference. One of the things I asked is if the integration dollars went away, would they backfill it with other funding? And they're looking into that possibility, but there's no guarantee.
Well, I would be interested because it isn't all, the money isn't going away. It's being distributed in a slightly different way, and Bloomington is a beneficiary. And
yes.
So I think it would be interesting to hear some discussion of that or some feedback.
Yes,
so
I would.
If you wouldn't mind, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for testifying.
And
if you would also sign in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Beth Webb.
That's a hard act to follow.
Welcome, Ms. Webb.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Beth Webb, and I serve as the Coordinator of Equity and Integration for the Cottonwood River Integration Collaborative. Madam Chair and committee members, I am here to provide a perspective from rural Minnesota on integration funding. The collaborative I work with is comprised of six districts: Cedar Mountain, GFW, New Ulm, Sleepy Eye, Springfield, and St. James. The average distance between our districts is nearly 30 miles. The communities that comprise our districts vary greatly in their amount of diversity. Cultural stereotypes were very prevalent and often distorted and incomplete in these districts. This has an impact not only socially, but academically as well. Since its beginning in 2002, CRIC has continually worked towards equity and excellence in education. I would like to share an example of one such initiative that has positively contributed to our success. CRIC provides classroom partnerships. These partnerships occur within the regular classroom and consist of three face-to-face interactions, Skype video conferencing to bridge the distance gap, and content centered on components of everyday curriculum. A story from how this programming positively impacts our learning. During one such kindergarten partnership, two kindergartners, one from Sleepy Eye and New Ulm, who are very diverse in their demographics, were working together. And a little girl from New Ulm appeared very frustrated with her partner that she was working with from Sleepy Eye. And when I asked her what was wrong, she said, "He's not listening to me." And I said, "Well, why do you feel that?" And she said, "He's not looking at my face." And without me saying anything, the little boy said, "My mom taught me that's not right and nice to look people in the face." These two then spent the rest of the day playing together and talking together. And at the end of the day, I asked the little girl if her partner was a good listener. And she said, "Yes, but he just listens differently than I do." We are preparing our students for a very global society. And those students were from two diverse backgrounds. If they were in a group together in a work setting and these students don't have the opportunity to learn what other cultural aspects there are of cultures aside from their own, I believe there will be some real issues in the future. I am in agreement that the statute needs accountability. I am in agreement that work needs to be done to amend the statute. I do agree with you that literacy is important, but I also feel strongly that the work of cultural awareness and integration is equally important. Please consider looking at the work of the task force that convened this past year. Their recommendations address those items. If we work together with our knowledge in the field and your expertise in the legislature, we can provide a great opportunity for our students. Rural Minnesota struggles to provide culturally diverse opportunities for students due to our location and our distance between districts. The collaborative model in this statute has allowed us to collaborate and accomplish this. And the transportation has also allowed us to bridge the distance gap. Without it, our students will not be as prepared to positively interact in a 21st century society. Minnesota can lead the way in integration, and we need your help. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Jan Alswager and Roger Aronson. Why don't you both come up? We're about at number 10 out of the 32, so we do need to finish up tonight. We won't be able to carry over to tomorrow, so please deliver as concise a message as you possibly can.
Madam Chair, members, Roger Aronson, I represent the Elementary and Secondary Principals Association. Ms. Alswager and I have talked about this a bit. I'm going to cover some of the tenure issues here. She's not going to repeat those, and then she'll make her statement
Thank
as
you.
Well. A couple things that we'd like the committee to look at. Some of the provisions that are in here come out of Senator Hand's bill and some of the other discussions that are around. But in Article 2, Section 7 and 14, these create the five-year renewable standards. These basically repeal the Teacher Tenure Act in terms of tenure provisions and put teachers on and principals as well on five-year contracts. And there are some standards in those. We think those need some closer review if the committee ultimately is going to decide that we're going to repeal tenure and move forward to the five-year contracts. And I might say that I know Ms. Alswager's group probably has a different view, but we've done quite a bit of surveying of school principals in response to several of the bills that have floated around, and I think that the five-year tenure piece has generated a significant amount of interest. So it's something we should talk about yet, but I think the position of our organizations would be, Madam Chair, that we think you ought to get all the groups going forward with this as a unified piece rather than top-down. Sections 9 and 15, the reason these sections are parallel, as the committee knows, we have two tenure acts. We have one that applies to cities of the first class, and then one that applies to everyone else, and they're not the same. So it causes some odd things for practitioners in the area. But you need to look at these provisions that are in 9 and 15. These have not been talked about much. Currently, the way that seniority works is that we lay teachers off in their area of licensure in the inverse order in which they were employed by the district. Licensure and length of service determine layoff. To the extent there's a proposal here, I think the committee is correct that that system does not work as well as it once did, and it needs some changes. The problem is that the change here that you've put in is too subjective. It says the superintendents can make those decisions if, in their judgment, the superintendent decides one individual can provide instruction that similarly licensed teachers cannot provide. Just give you a little example here. Of our elementary teachers have a large span of grades, 1 through 5, and assume, and basically that's one license as elementary. If someone's been teaching 4th grade for a long time, the superintendent could say, I'm going to exempt you from the layoff process, even though the 2nd grade teacher may have a longer length of service. Maybe that's a good plan, maybe it's a bad plan, but that's probably a good 2-hour discussion, Madam Chair, of how we should do that. We've addressed that issues in some individual contracts as they relate to principals. In particular, if you have Spanish immersion school, we deem it's appropriate that the principal speak Spanish, even though there isn't a Spanish-speaking license piece, we can negotiate that locally. So this issue needs to be talked about more, I think, than it is here in the bill at this point. We have some question about whether this works, and we think you should lay that over for another time. Subdivision 10 as well has a significant change in the discharge process, and that's somewhat troubling to us as well. So these are technical issues that we think need to be worked out. They're good issues. They're worth talking about, and hopefully we can do some good work on them. But as they exist in the bill, we think there's some workability problems with the manager.
Thank you, Mr. Aronson. Ms. Alswager.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Alswager, Education Minnesota, and I would agree with Mr. Aronson's comments, and so I won't repeat those. I would say that we probably maybe have a little different opinion about the tenure issue, and I would just offer that Education Minnesota would be very willing to work with you on a teacher evaluation bill so that we have teachers evaluated appropriately, and test scores, yes, can be taken into consideration. We don't think that there's a magic percentage or a magic test that tells if teachers are effective. But we would think that putting our efforts towards teacher evaluation is a much smarter way of dealing with teacher effectiveness versus some of the tenure issues. I would then go on to our concerns about the integration aid and suggest to you that rather than making these cuts quite quickly, I think, that maybe we should spend more time talking about the best way to fund our schools. The governor does have an education funding task force, and we think that effort should be made to try to determine the best way to fund our schools. We are opposed to the Safe Schools levy. I've been on record saying that before, so I will leave it at that at this point. We are concerned with the salary freeze and the qualified economic offer. They are two provisions in the bill that basically have the same impact. As I've stated before in testimony, our salaries have been dropping in rank compared to the rest of the country, from number 8 back in the early 90s to now number 20th. And the teacher's salaries in percentage of a school budget have dropped from 40% approximately to 38%. So we don't know what the problem would be. The bottom line, I think, is that teacher's salaries would drop even farther than they are. And I believe I've mentioned in this committee, we have some teachers making not even $45,000 after 25 years of teaching. And we think that that's not appropriate. I thought I should mention this to you, too, related to the salary freeze. If the salary freeze were adopted and there was a hard freeze, no steps, no lanes, no insurance, if there was a total hard freeze, do you know that when the settlement was reported, but there really wouldn't be a settlement, but if you costed out that hard freeze, do you know that it would look like a 1% increase to teachers? Why is that? Because last year you passed a pension bill. Education Minnesota originally opposed it, and then we decided to go along with it, that increased the school board's contribution to pensions and the teachers' contribution to pensions. But that school board increase in contribution is costed against them, and it would be seen as a benefit to them. Interesting. Even if you had a hard freeze, the teachers would look, it would look like they got a 1% increase. We are concerned about the repealer of the staff development on the January 15th, which we've talked about numerous times, Madam Chair, so I won't go into that any further because of the interest of time. And then one last item that I would mention is that we do have concerns about the requirement that salary increases would be based on student achievement. At least 50% of their salary increase would be based on student achievement. We don't think that there's a magic test. We don't think that there's a magic percentage that tells us if teachers are effective teachers. We always, of course, want to have teachers improve and do their very best with kids. But we don't think that this provision really gets to that objective. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Altreger. I make just a couple notes. One, you now are on record as saying that you oppose the Safe Schools levy. I hope you don't really mean that. That's a catch. I know what you mean, but that's what you said.
Madam Chair, thank you. We oppose the provision in the bill that eliminates the Safe Schools levy.
That'd be a piece of it.
Yeah,
it doesn't eliminate the levy. We have
correct.
Not eliminated the levy.
You're correct. Yes. You're correct. Thank you.
Also, the issue of the 50% of the increase attributed to student achievement, we specifically left that so that to be determined locally. It's not a prescriptive approach. So it isn't locked in, and I think we fall into the habit of thinking that somehow we've got to tell you precisely what to do on all things, and hopefully we've got professionals out there that are capable of developing and working and bringing about with the spirit of things as well as everything to the letter of the law. So, I mean, that's just a concept to think about as we are going forward even considering this provision.
We appreciate that value, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that.
Senator Rieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Altswager, you mentioned the willingness to work on teacher evaluations, and I think I read in your Ed Minnesota publications you had proposals in last fall. We've seen legislative proposals rolled out here in January. Has your organization been invited to participate in discussions? I just don't know why things are so apart. Is there any involvement formally in a process?
Madam Chair and Senator Uyghur, I think to varying degrees, maybe later on in the process. This bill is going forward, and in the other body, the bill is going forward. I actually have to say thank you to Senator Olson for not including a number of the provisions that were in an evaluation bill that we had significant concerns about. They are not in here. There's portions of it, so we would really like to thank you for that. And I think that as this bill goes forward and we go into conference committee, that Education Minnesota will be right there to try to get an evaluation program in our schools to make sure that teachers are evaluated appropriately. And so we're extending the invitation, and I think that, there are things that need to be done sometimes to, everybody has to operate within their group, and we're willing to help out.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to both of you. Joe Nathan. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Nathan. I direct the Center for School Change at McAllister College. I've been a public school teacher and administrator, PTA president, member of the state board of the PTA, and otherwise involved in various issues in education in Minnesota since the fall of 1970. I speak as a representative of our organization, but as not a representative of McAllister or any other organization. I want to make five major points, the first of which is to congratulate the chair and the committee for producing very critical, not just important, but critical conversation in this state. The reality is that while we have much to be proud of in Minnesota, we also have a long, long way to go. And many other states are making considerably more progress than we have over the last 5 to 10 years, and it's not just about money. So I want to congratulate the committee and the committee chair and her staff for raising important questions about a number of things happening in Minnesota. Winston Churchill at one point said, "However beautiful the strategy, you occasionally have to look at the results." And we've heard a good deal in the last hour about anecdotes, and I think anecdotes have a very important place, unquestionably. But I also think it's important to look at data. So the first point I want to make is to congratulate you on raising important questions. The second is to say that we know how to reduce and indeed eliminate the achievement gap. One of the sides of the article that's been distributed, which is available for others over here, is an article that we wrote for the Star Tribune that describes how over a period of 5 years with the help of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we were able to eliminate, not just reduce, but eliminate the graduation gap between white and African American youngsters. And one of the central things that we did, and there were 10 key strategies, not just one, but one of the central things that we did was to identify outstanding schools, whether they were district or charter, throughout the United States. That is a critical idea. It is something that is included in this bill, and I want to talk about that in just a moment. It's also a critical idea included in Governor Dayton and Commissioner Casilius' recommendations, and I want to encourage significant attention to this idea. We would, if the legislature decides to work with the commissioner and governor on this, we would become the first state that explicitly says to the citizens, we are going to identify the outstanding district and charter public schools in the state, honor them, encourage them, and learn from them. It is way past time to be doing that. There have been endless debates about which is better, district or charter. We have examples of superb schools in greater Minnesota, some districts, some charter, in suburbs, in rural areas. I'm going to talk about Senator Stump's area in just a minute, which is why I have some data about your district, sir, about Thief River Falls, and some outstanding work that's going on there. We have schools from which we could learn a great deal more. And whether it is the precise details in this bill, which I commend you for in terms of recognizing the importance of reading, or what is the precise details of what the governor is recommending K-12, I think the central idea that the commissioner, the governor, and you, Madam Chair, are calling for, which is to identify the outstanding schools, district or charter, and make much greater use of them. I think that is an absolutely critical principle, and something, if we did it in this state, would be the first, once again, in the United States to do. So my second point is that it is possible to close the achievement gap. Like a lot of other things, building a house, for example, it requires a lot of tools, a lot of strategies. It's not any single thing. There's no silver bullet. But the first thing is to believe that we can do it. And I know from long experience with the commissioner and, frankly, also with the commissioner who actually taught our children, she did a marvelous job 20 years ago, and I know with the chair of the committee that you are both deeply committed to recognizing that we can, in our schools today, with current resources, make huge differences for our kids. The third thing I want to talk about briefly is the importance of reading. Whether it is this precise bill or whether there are some modifications, there is simply no question that one of the central priorities of our time must be to have kids reading well by the end of the third grade. Madam Chair, you have worked in a bipartisan way on this issue for a number of years. The research is increasingly clear. I cite briefly on one side of this page the report just out of the Annie Casey Foundation less than a year ago, why reading by the end of the third grade matters. And there are several quotes. I won't take the committee's time to read them. The central point here is if youngsters are not reading well by the end of the third grade, they are much more likely to do poorly in school. They are much more likely to drop out. They are much more likely to be involved in prison. Madam Chair, you are absolutely right to be focusing the state's attention on the importance of reading. And as you know, you have a corporate partner, and I don't speak for them, but one of the largest corporations in the state based here, which is a national corporation, Target, has committed $500 million to this issue in cash because they completely agree with your analysis that having youngsters read by the end of third grade is absolutely critical. Finally, I want to emphasize that demography and demographics are not destiny. And, for example, we see that Thief River Falls has a higher-than-state-average proficiency rate, even higher-than-state-average proficiency rate, even though they also have a higher-than-state-average percentage of low-income students. And if you go through, you will see that there are a number of places around the state where demography does not equal destiny. I also have put up on the top the schools, public schools, district and charter that were identified by the Minneapolis Star Tribune last year, and you will see that despite the fact that here in the state we have 36% low-income kids on average, many of the schools identified by the Star Tribune as beating the odds have 85 to 95% low-income kids, and yet they are right at or just under by a few percent the statewide average. My point, Madam Chair, is that, again, to emphasize, you and the commissioner and the governor agree it is past time to learn from the most outstanding schools and that reading is one area that unquestionably needs focus. Many years ago, and this is my final point, many years ago I was told by some educators that I ought to believe in the NOAH principle. That's N-O-A-H. And the NOAH principle is no more prizes for predicting rain. It is prizes only for building arcs. And I believe that with bipartisan work, we can identify the most outstanding schools, that we should honor, encourage, and help them to teach others around the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nathan. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Stump.
Just think of where Thief River Falls could be if we had some money for staff development.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nathan, I have a question related to this initiative. Impossible to disagree with the value of having really a strategy in place for reading. And part of the problem we have now is that the way this reallocation of dollars works out is that it actually generates more dollars for schools that are doing well. And so Minnesota does not have a system in place to assess children early on, kindergarten, first grade, even before they enter kindergarten. So in terms of figuring out how do we make progress and how do we measure growth at that age, I presume that what we will be doing here is actually providing extra dollars to schools that are, you know, getting kids that probably will be reading Harry Potter by first grade. And so we will be really providing those incentives more and more versus allocating dollars for those schools that receive kids that, you know, have never read a book before they enter kindergarten. We don't have that process in this bill. So we don't have a process of assessing literacy skills early on, figuring out what is progress, how do we measure growth, how do we help those schools where we have high concentration of young kids that actually have zero, you know, that don't have the skills necessary because we don't know how to assess. But yet we're putting a chunk of money that is taken out of integration from the schools where we have high concentration of those kids that really need to be measured. And we're spreading that money around. And my fear is that we are going to really provide incentives and dollars to schools that are doing well. And so my question is how much do we, so when a child is doing well in terms of reading and then we, you know, provide extra compensation for that and more funding, what else are they supposed to do? What, you know, a school in Edina that has a kid that is reading fluently in first grade and then they will move on to second and third grade, they will be excellent. What else can they do? Is that where we need to go in terms of providing dollars?
Madam Chair,
Mr.
Senator, you raised very important points. I'm going to make a few points in response out of respect for the committee. First, Senator Torres-Ray, there's no question about your deep commitment to all kinds of kids, including kids who don't speak English in the home, but to all kinds of kids. In South Minneapolis, the Star Tribune identified an extraordinary school working with low-income kids, students who don't speak English in the home, and that school has a great deal to teach schools all over the state about how to work with such kids. So I believe that it is important to identify the schools that are working with significant percentages of low-income kids, specific percentages of kids who don't speak English, and have them working in a very systematic way with schools throughout the state. Secondly, you make a very important and I think completely valid point about assessment of kindergarten, first, and second grade. We worked with the help of Cargill Foundation for several years with the Minneapolis Public Schools and several charters, and there are ways to measure in a valid and reliable way academic achievement in the kindergarten, first, and second grade. You're right. The statewide test doesn't cover kindergarten and first grades, but we do have valid and reliable ways to assess this. Third, we have a rather bizarre situation in operation right now where schools that are at the very bottom, in many cases, not all, but in many cases in this state, received $1 million each last year from taxpayers, from the U.S. Department of Education, to improve themselves. And yet the schools that are showing significant improvement, many of which, as documented on this sheet, are schools serving low-income kids. They're receiving nothing. So this is one of the reasons that I'm intrigued and very supportive of the commissioner and governor's approach, which is to identify schools that are showing significant growth and are showing significant progress. And I believe that this is a part of this bill as well, to honor and reward schools that are showing significant growth as well as absolute achievement. I'm not endorsing every provision and every line in this bill, but I am commending the chair and the commissioner and governor for saying there's a very important principle here, which is to identify the schools that are making considerable progress. We work with the Cargill Foundation. We work with schools in Senator Stumpf and a number of other parts of rural Minnesota, and we identified schools that were making terrific progress, and folks learned from each other. But this needs to be done on a systemic basis, and that's what I'm suggesting.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mr. Nathan. We are going to have to move on, and I ask you, please, to respect 2 to 3 minutes. we want to give the commissioner a chance to say something, but I'd like to have everybody have a chance to say their piece. So let's be as concise as possible. Gene Piccolo. If you have somebody, is David Greenberg with you?
David Greenberg and Nancy Schultz.
Pardon me?
Nancy Schultz also.
All right. Why don't you all three come up, and if you can kind of give us
Madam
one
Chair,
message, that would be great.
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Piccolo.
Members, thank you for the opportunity to share a few concerns and comments about some of the provisions of the bill. First, I want to thank you again for including the provision about the one-year extension for authorizers in this bill. This issue is continuing its involvement in the process in both houses. However, there are three provisions of the bill that affect charter schools that I would like to speak to directly that would have significant impact on charter schools. First, the elimination of state startup aid for charter schools would send a message that state policy is no longer in support of creation of new charter schools. It is argued that state startup funding is not needed because there is federal startup funds for charter schools. It is true that there have been federal funds, but there is no guarantee or assurance that there will be any funding going forward after this fiscal year. The federal charter school program grant Minnesota has had for the last several years is at its end. Just last week, the Minnesota Department of Education submitted an application for a new grant, but Congress has not yet appropriated any funding for the program this fiscal year, and it is unclear what they will do with this program, as the charter school program is part of the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. The second concern we have is the elimination of the lease aid grandfather clause, which would mean that a number of schools that are receiving funding through the grandfather clause would be put in the position of potentially defaulting on their lease agreements, especially those schools that have long-term leases through affiliated building companies. Both Mr. Greenberg and Ms. Schultz could speak to that issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is David Greenberg. I'm the director of El Colegio Charter School, a small high school in South Minneapolis. Our school has fallen under the grandfather clause of the charter school lease aid legislation. We've been around for 11 years. And ending that grandfather clause would have a very adverse effect on our school, effectively cutting $35,000 to $45,000 from our budget, approximately the equivalent of one teacher. And over 70% of our students are Latino from South Minneapolis. We serve about 80 students. In addition, we have approximately 70 students coming to our program, to our school for after-school programming, who come from Minneapolis Public Schools as well as Richfield Schools. And this is a time when we need to, we're seeing that other particularly Latino-serving organizations in South Minneapolis are struggling. Some have closed. Our school and our center has really become an important resource for South Minneapolis, for the Latino families there. And so,
could I just stop you a bit? You don't need to sell us on your program.
Sure.
We're for that. Do you have any potential of renegotiating that lease, or because you're with an affiliated a building corporation, is that a tight link so that there's no chance for negotiation?
We have actually negotiated the lease down from the initial lease of about 3 or 4 years ago. And so we have actually negotiated that down. And I think we could not negotiate it down any further based on the debt service.
The current bill would give you $250 more per student than what you're currently getting, even with that provision. So, take a look at it, but let's keep in touch on that, and I appreciate your bringing that issue forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Schultz?
My name is Nancy Schultz, and I'm the business manager at APSA High School Academy for Sciences and Agriculture. You probably don't want to hear about our program, but I'm going to tell it anyway. We're a small school in Van Nuys Heights, high school 9 through 12. We have always made AYP. 90% of our students graduate on time. 80 to 90% of our students go on to post-secondary education, including the class of 2010. 60 of our students, we've received $250,000 in college scholarships. We're one of the 10 high schools and the only charter high school that won the 2009 Minnesota Academic Excellence Foundation School Spotlight Award, an award for academic excellence and student success. Recently, we were mentioned in the Minnesota School Boards Association Journal by Joel Larson, an education specialist at MDE, as the best of the best in the small schools category for best ag ed program. Our lease is with an affiliated building company, and we cannot renegotiate our lease, mostly because it has to do when you can, every 10 years or every 15 years, you could go back to the bondholders and try to renegotiate. We're not at that point. The lease is based on bond funding, but at a favorable rate of 5.5% to 6% over 30 years. Our building is a quality school building that is appropriate for high school learning environment. To eliminate the grandfather clause in the lease for our school would be devastating. The amount for our school would be $47,000 each year for the next 20 years. We have already made significant cuts in our school to compensate for the holdback costs and cash flow financing. Our staff has not received, we've had a wage freeze for over 3 years, and they still come back and work at our school. But now we would have to face eliminating programs such as our CIS classes, AP, and our AG classes that make our school unique and stand out. Mm-hmm. So please do not eliminate the grandfathered lease aid, as we have no recourse to change our lease. On behalf of AFSA High School, I invite you all to visit our school, our facility, our staff, and our students to see our success in student learning. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, a final point is concerned about making the 70-30 holdback an ongoing formula with no assurance of when there will be a payback of the shift. This creates enormous difficulties for charter schools to get lines of credit for cash flow needs. Right now, charter schools do not have access to low-interest loans like traditional districts, which are paying at 1% or 2%, because we do not have the ability to use revenues like property taxes as collateral. Charter schools are paying between 6 and 23% in loan fees, interest for borrowing short-term cash flow. This past year, 110 of the 149 schools have reported they've spent almost $1 million in interest costs alone, which is coming out of the classroom. A report will be coming from the Nonprofit Assistance Fund for MACS and Charter School Partners later this week, which delves into this issue of the impact, financial impact it has on the holdback on charter schools and the interest schools are paying. So a great deal of money is coming out of the classroom to pay for interest for short-term borrowing because of the holdback.
That was because of the initial shift, but 100% of the formula is coming each year going forward. That is that the carryover from the impact of when it was implemented? The going forward.
Every year, charter schools need to do cash flow, because most of them are not been in existence, and they don't have huge reserve funds. So they have to borrow money, especially for the summer months when the payments for schools are lower.
When we have time, you can walk that through. We haven't got time today to help me understand, because 100% of the formula still gets to you in a calendar year. It's just that we shifted it at a time, and there was a block of time in that recognition.
Madam Chair, members, could I just mention, what happens is that we have to borrow against the holdback, and then when the holdback comes due, we have to pay the bank or the loan off. And so we're short again, and we have to keep borrowing.
It's what happened with the first time. It was the decisions that you needed to make at that time that were the issue, not what's the amount that you're receiving each year.
Madam Chair, that occurs every year, that holdback. And so they have to borrow money for that difference until the holdback is paid at the end of the year.
Correct with that, but we'll follow up later. Thank you very much.
And we thank you for the opportunity to follow up with
you. Yes, thank you. Ms. King, Kim King, and Brad Lundell. Two different organizations, but be on track here. Ms. King.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Kim Kang with the ARC of Minnesota, and I'm here today to actually oppose capping special education revenue. With the state cross-subsidy approaching $632 million in 2012, we'll continue to put pressure on schools as they must move funds from other areas of their budget to cover these costs. As it stands, we currently only pay 60% of special education salaries when we promise 68%. Capping special education revenue will cause further inequities between school districts and negatively impact student achievement. education is about all kids, and that includes kids in special education. And if I can quickly add, I know the elephant in the room is always how if, you know, Minnesota exceeds in laws and rules, that somehow if we could just get back to the minimum standards, we could save money. You know, we've had a special ed task force between 2007 and 2009 to look at all these issues. We had equal representation from schools and advocates. We changed things we needed to change. We continue to have this discussion about the paperwork burden that all these rules and regulations and laws cause our schools. Yet no one seems to be able to point to very specific things that causes this paperwork to happen or if it's related to a state or federal law or rule. So, you know, I guess I would like to actually encourage the legislature to be a little more visionary in how they look at this issue because we continue to kind of grind around in this paperwork burden piece.
Ms. Kang, that's not a part of the bill. I know that there's some fear that something may be coming, but that isn't what we're addressing in it.
So okay, well, I just wanted to bring that up.
I did get the message on the funding, but the revenue is being spread. They are getting
right.
It. They still have to deliver the service, and most school districts are getting more, not less.
Right.
So, and the cross-subsidy, you know, will continue
right.
Until the federal government delivers on some of their promises.
Exactly.
Well.
I'm hoping that the committee will be a little more visionary in how they look at this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Mr. Lund, yes, Ms. Eben.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I actually have a question for you about this provision of the bill. Did we hear any bill related to capping the special ed funding, the growth factor?
I'm not sure that we did.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell from Schools for Equity and Education. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on your bill today. First of all, I want to thank you for the target. I think working hard to have the target as high as it is, given what's happening in other parts of state government, is testament to your support for public education that's been both longstanding and strong. I want to say thank you for the formula increase, the basic formula increase of $50 in each of the next 2 years. Schools for Equity and Education is a set of school districts that's highly reliant on a strong basic formula, and that's the engine that most assuredly funds our school districts, and most surely funds it, and we certainly want to thank you for that. Also want to thank you for the mandate relief in terms of the maintenance of effort, in terms of the staff development set-aside and the staff development distribution formula. And also, I guess, while the pay freeze is controversial, and I think that every organization here is having trouble grappling with it, I think it's important that it be on the table as things go to conference committee. And I do think that having that in the bill is for discussion at a later date is important. I want to give a good news, bad news on the literacy approach that it seems to come out of Senator Hand's bill. The good news is I think that's a great formula that looks at literacy by third grade and promoting that. The bad news is where you got the money. And moving money amongst school districts is always very difficult. And given the budget that we have, I realize that that's the way that you had to go. But it would be much easier had you had money, more money, to do those kinds of things. And so taking money from one and giving to another is something that I think everyone in on our end of the table really doesn't enjoy doing. And I'm sure most folks here don't enjoy it as well. I want to thank you. I want to thank Senator Stump and you. We finally have gotten more money in the bill for vocational education. I think that we've been waiting a long time to see these types of increases. Student opportunities in vocational education, it's been we see probably some reinventing going on, but also I think just those opportunities need to be there. And I know that you had Mike Myron come in from Forest Lake. You can just see what's happening in vocational education and probably what needs to happen, and to have the resources there to continually promote that will be very, very helpful. Just picking up on Kim Kang's comment, in the Article 3, the freezing of the special ed is troublesome to us as well. It's because there's distributional effects going from special ed to general ed. There is going to be the cross-subsidy. That cross-subsidy is going to have different effects district to district. I've got both winners and losers in that crowd. I just think that, again, the shortage of overall dollars to look at what we need to do in terms of special ed vis-a-vis, I think your comments vis-a-vis the federal government are very important. and something that we can't overlook in this. I wish they had more money as well, I guess. But with that, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Stand for any questions. If not, I look forward to working with you in the rest of this session and especially in the near future on this bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay. Thank you. Mary Nino and Eric Hauge from Child Care Works and Ready for K.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Eric Hauge with Ready for K. Ready for K is a statewide early childhood advocacy and policy organization committed to all kids being ready for school. We work with a broad coalition of organizations here at the Capitol on behalf of our youngest citizens, and so coming here to you to first say thanks. We're very grateful to your leadership and to the committee members for displaying their priorities and maintaining funding for the state's vital early childhood programs. These are the programs that help lay the foundation not only for our children's kindergarten readiness but for the future prosperity of our state. The children in these programs will benefit right now, and in 10, 15, and 20 years, we'll see a more prosperous and well-educated society as a result. We're also very pleased on the focus on literacy by the third grade. We know that if kids are ready for kindergarten, they are more likely to do well in third grade. One small area of concern we have with the bill is lack of movement on a statewide quality rating and improvement system or parent aware for early childhood providers. Minnesota families are demanding quality early childhood settings for their children, whether in family child care or school-based programs, and a QRIS is the first step towards helping parents choose quality. It also begins to link state funding of early childhood programs to quality standards, providing the state with more accountability, knowing that our dollars are getting the best bang for their buck. Going forward, we sincerely hope that the Senate will be open to exploring the quality rating and improvement system in more detail. Thanks for your commitment to Minnesota's children, and we look forward to working with you going forward.
Thanks, Mr. Hogan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Nino. I'm the Executive Director of Child Care Works. We are a statewide child care advocacy organization whose mission is to achieve and sustain high-quality child care options for families and communities. We, too, are disappointed that a statewide voluntary quality rating and improvement system was not included in the finance bill. It was one of only three items identified in our 2011 policy agenda and is a significant agreed-upon priority among experts, researchers, advocates, parents, and providers working within the early childhood community. Our work with parents and providers over the past 30 years, the experience of the Parent Aware pilot sites in St. Paul, Minneapolis, Wayzata, and Blue Earth County have shown again and again how important it is that parents receive information about the quality of child care settings in order to choose the most appropriate placement for their child. Wilder Research's 2009 child care use survey indicated that 88% of parents would like a quality rating system in their community that provides this information on quality child care. That had not changed from when the survey was done in 2004. It was still at 88%. We also know that child care providers crave and make use of every opportunity to improve the services that they provide to children and families. As I testified before, Child Care Works has conducted listening sessions with child care providers across the state to listen to their experiences as well as their concerns regarding the statewide implementation of the quality rating system. What we have ascertained from these sessions and research conducted by Wilder about community assets is that a QRIS will successfully increase child care quality and improve parent information. A rating system.
Ms. Nino, yes, I think ma'am. We don't have that before us.
I know
that you're trying to make that pitch, but there's, you know, the legislature isn't going to go away, and I don't know that this issue, it just hasn't been resolved in relation to this bill and the various jurisdictions that proposal covered. So there's some challenges to it.
Yep.
So we get the message.
Okay. Madam Chair, and if there's anything we can do to assist you, please let us know.
Thank you. Karen Ephraim?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. My name is Karen Ephraim. I'm here on behalf of Education Liberty Watch, and my testimony will be the opposite of what you just heard. We really
appreciate... If you can make it brief,
yes,
please.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
We really, really appreciate the reforms that you are doing overall in this bill, and particularly in the areas of early childhood. We very much appreciate that you didn't include the MELF quality rating system or funding for all-day kindergarten, and I emailed you all research as to why that is a wise decision, and I will answer questions if you want. On early childhood literacy, I want to say that the statute 119A.50 talks about research base, but it doesn't mention phonics or phonemic awareness. And as you're increasing funding for early childhood literacy, we think that that's really, really important. And also the K through 3 portion of that as well, I think it should be more explicit. And we would just say that given the national studies showing fade out of Head Start by first grade, harm to the math skills of three-year-olds, and evidence of fraud that some or all of Head Start, the state portion, should be cut. The kindergarten readiness assessment has really significant questions about validity. And according to former Commissioner Segrin, scares the public and brands children as failures before the age of 5, doing a disservice to families and the good work of those in the field. And the $100,000 of the Educate Parents Partnership should be cut, as we really don't need to be spending tax dollars to tell parents how to parent. So as the numbers keep moving around, I would just ask you to keep that in mind.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you. Thomas Sitz.
Madam
Chair. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Sieben.
Well, I just wanted, Dr. Ephraim, I sent you an email earlier today that the link you actually sent to us, we couldn't access those. So if you could resend those so we could see what you're trying to send, that'd be helpful.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, I actually responded and got you correct links, and I will be providing that for the rest of the committee. And thank you for pointing out the problem.
Thank you. Mr. Citron Heisen?
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Tom Citron Heisen, and I represent the Literacy Action Network, which is a statewide advocacy group for adult basic education. Each year we serve nearly 80,000 adults, providing ESL training, basic skills training, GED, family literacy, and a wide variety of other educational services. I'd just like to speak very briefly, and I'll speak fast, which I'm pretty good at doing, to talk a little bit about the proposed permanent reduction in the growth part of the formula from 3% to 2%. And I want the committee to understand how we're funded, because it is very different than K-12. And we are not funded on a per-pupil allocation basis. The 3% growth factor is not an inflationary increase. It provides additional revenue as we serve more and more learners each year. For instance, last year, our total contact hours, which formed the basis of our funding, grew by 8.5%, while funding only increased by 3%. And that has happened year after year after year. There's been an average of a little bit over 6% growth in hours each year for the past 10 years. So that's decreased the contact rate over time. It fell from $11.01 an hour in 2001 to $7.87 an hour last year. So the impact of that is that it's fallen. We also, federal funding at the same time has fallen 19%. So over time, we've done more and more with less and less, and we've really reached the point now where further reductions will mean a wide variety of things we'll have to start doing to actually reduce services. We did a very impromptu poll of some of our members, our consortia around the state. Some of the things that people are concerned with, managers are saying they will need to do if there are decreases in funding, fewer teachers, fewer students, fewer classes in Washington County. Cutting van transportation for students in areas without public transportation, less GED testing in Rosemount, Apple Valley, Eagan, reducing this annual schedule by 2 weeks and longer wait times for learners in Moorhead, fewer sites, less professional development in the Arrowhead region, longer waiting list Mankato, shortened class times, drop some classes in Le Sueur, et cetera. So I want the committee to be aware that we are trying very hard to meet the needs of our adult population that lacks basic skills. During the recession, our enrollment has really gone up dramatically, and we've stretched and stretched and are trying to do the best we can. And we do appreciate your support, but we also want you to know what a decrease in funding will do for us.
Well, thank you very much. You're suggesting, as a couple others here, is that we shouldn't agree with the governor on some of his proposals.
I fully wish the governor would include our full 3% growth rate. And then I'd just like to close by very briefly mentioning that, because I know there's so much concern about the achievement gap, that adult basic education services really directly affect that. Because if parents can learn to support literacy activities in their children in their own homes, it really increases achievement. Children's literacy levels are very strongly related to the educational level of their parents, especially their mothers. Children and parents that are unemployed and have not completed high school are 5 times more likely to drop out of school. And children participating in family literacy programs in a number of U.S. cities showed an 80% increase in reading books and made twice as many trips to the library. So
in closing, I
just want to thank you for your support of Adult Basic Ed.
Thank you,
and
Jeff.
Hope you'll be able to fully fund us. Thank you very much.
Commissioner Casilius. Thank you for coming today.
Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members.
Commissioner.
I stayed up until about 2 a.m. reading your bill and feel the immense pressure, as you do, in this $5 billion deficit. It is troubling for sure. But I thank you for hearing my testimony today. As I said yesterday when testifying about the House education proposal, I am hopeful that throughout this legislative process, we will have a serious dialogue about the best ways to serve Minnesota students, teachers, and schools. I'm also hopeful that our dialogue is premised on finding common ground. However, like the proposal offered in the House, the education bill introduced today makes it very difficult to find common ground. I must tell you, I am so disheartened by these proposals. I am puzzled by the bill's disregard for the unique and challenging circumstances facing cities of the first class when it comes to meeting the needs of our students who come through our school doors and the potential ripple effects to all Minnesota's children. This impact will affect all Minnesota's children. It is not my nature to be critical, but as commissioner, I feel a responsibility to stand up for all children, and especially for our most vulnerable children and families, many of whom live in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, and whose opportunity for a quality education would be seriously hampered by this bill. And as a Minneapolis resident and the mother of 2 Minneapolis public school children, I share a belief that as Minnesotans, we are better than this. We have a rich history in Minnesota of welcoming people from other countries and walks of life. Our traditions have woven a rich tapestry of diversity in our great state. This has enhanced our quality of life. It's what has given us our own special brand of Minnesota nice. But today, I sit here wondering, where is our shared belief in our neighborly Minnesota nice? This bill cuts programs that directly support poor kids and kids of color. At a time when the number of children living in poverty is increasing and when diversity is increasing, this bill cuts funding for those very children. It unfairly makes deeper cuts to cities of the first class while increasing funding for wealthier districts. After 60 years of struggling to get it right regarding integration, do we just want to give up? This bill ends our commitment to racially integrated schools. This bill cuts special education and the special education excess levy and will surely lead to higher property taxes. This bill compromises the Department of Education's ability to provide adequate oversight and support for our teachers and teaching and learning of our children. And this bill targets public employees and teachers. Madam Chair and members, we have a constitutional responsibility to provide a uniform system of education to every student. This bill would make it impossible to meet that obligation. After 10 years of NCLB, of bashing schools and teachers, labeling them as failures, taking away their creative passion, and replacing it with testing and false accountability, parents and the public are ready for something more. They want us to change the conversation and find real common ground about the best way to improve our schools and all our children. Most of us in this room can agree on the need for some fundamental changes that will improve the way we serve our students. And all of us recognize the serious nature of the budget crisis we face. It is not an overstatement to say that we are at a tipping point in public education and in Minnesota. Our actions this session will determine the future for nearly a million children. Our actions will shape the future of our Minnesota schools. And our actions will set the course for a quality of life as Minnesotans. We cannot be short-sighted. We cannot be rushing. We must be forward-thinking in order to find better solutions we all believe in. We now have the opportunity to find common ground, specifically on getting all children reading well by third grade, such as your proposal to support the Reading Corps. Reading, rewarding educational excellence and innovation, supporting early learning, and finding solutions to ensure the best and brightest teachers are in every child's classroom. This is where we have common ground. We've already made one big step together with the passage of alternative pathways. And I know and firmly believe we can do even more together. Governor Dayton has stated often that a budget bill is about our values and priorities as much as it is about dollars and cents. This means we must exercise great thought and deliberation in how we proceed. We must reaffirm our commitment to start from the places of common ground so that we can ensure that we enact a true reflection of all Minnesotans' values. Unfortunately, the Senate bill before me today does not reflect the kind of Minnesota values Governor Dayton and I can support. The governor and I are eager to begin a serious and thoughtful discussion about the best ways to support Minnesota schools and students. Again, we want to work with you in the areas of supporting our youngest learners, reading well by third grade, ensuring great teaching and closing of the achievement gaps. We hope to begin that serious discussion soon so that we may complete our work in a timely and respectful manner Minnesotans expect and deserve from their leaders. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, there's an important part of this bill that I didn't hear you speak about, and I would hope that it's something that we do have common ground on, and that is providing more money on the per pupil funding for every student. This not only gets more money into our classrooms, but it also gives districts great flexibility in how they use that money. I didn't hear you address that. Could you address that aspect of our bill, please?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Madam Chair.
Commissioner?
I'm going to ask Tom Melcher to come and help me with the formula. Yes, Madam Chair.
Commissioner?
The formula is increased by $50 for school districts. However, the cuts that are realized to our inner city schools and our children in poverty are much greater than the $50 additional dollars, as well as the cross subsidy for the special ed.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to clarify, I believe over the biennium it's $150. Is that correct?
But it's $50 each year, which would be the state cost is $150.
Yes,
the first 50 is built into the formula,
yes.
And a 50 is added to it.
Yep. So $150 of new per pupil funding for the biennium.
Senator Rieger.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, are you saying we're robbing Peter to pay Paul?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
In my comments, Senator Wieger, I believe that we have big winners and big losers in this bill.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Torres-Bray.
Thank you. Commissioner, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your comments and how much I appreciate your knowledge of what is happening with this formula. I, too, share your passion and your commitment to low-income children. And they are the reason I ran for office. What is very difficult for me to understand is how divided we are today. And I look forward to really find opportunities to work with you and to work with members here. I have been talking with my neighbor, Senator Cruz, about really the need to look into reports that I reviewed early on when I came here as a freshman, because I came here with great passion to correct some of the problems we have and the disparities that we have, not only in terms of achievement gap, but the disparities in funding and how much we really need to look at how we use funding today, accountability, all of those measures and values I value greatly. And I think that we have opportunities to correct some problems. But clearly taking money away from the poorest children is ill-conceived. Minneapolis and St. Paul are losing a lot of dollars that are going to go to more affluent districts. These $50 come from the poorest neighborhoods in the state of Minnesota. They're going to be distributed among wealthier neighborhoods. That's just not fair. It's just not fair. So thank you for acknowledging that and for bringing your expertise and being able to really call it for what it is. Thank you.
Senator Torres Ray, with all due respect, and I appreciate your passion, from the figures that you've given me, Minneapolis budget equals $20,000 per pupil. And from the figures that were given me today by the school board chairman in St. Paul, $16,300. These formula changes, and it goes up at one point, it comes down a bit. I was not interested in doing any slash and burn. Minneapolis would be getting at least $19,750, approximately at $250 nick in that, and St. Paul, $16,050. To say that you're taking away from these districts to give to other districts, where do you think a lot of that money is coming from to help these schools? I don't want to deprive the children of Minneapolis and St. Paul and Duluth and other districts of any opportunity.
Okay.
But, I also hear the questions raised. We've had some good reports of things, as Mr. Nathan, I think, brought up, that we get a lot of anecdotal kinds of things. But part of what we're trying to do here is to bring some linkage to some of these important things that we're talking about and tying some of that funding to it. So when we see that these schools have greatly elevated and have their growth in that literacy as well as the proficiency, send that money back that way. And that's what we're trying to do with that literacy incentive aid. The other is a small distribution that came from a couple of the growth factors, not from the integration, on the formula. Because I think there's districts that all around the state that are hurting too. They're having a difficult time. And so just trying to do something modest in that area is what we're trying to do in difficult times. So I don't want you to feel that this is some effort to really devastate our core cities with the challenges that they face. But it is a challenge to try to turn things around and to see where the money, how this money can be invested to bring the best return. And that's the challenge of of our core cities, but it's a challenge of all of us and for all of our districts. So I just want to relate that. I saw a hand here.
Madam Chair, I feel like I need to do a follow-up to your presentation. Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Mr. Naumann, and maybe tomorrow will be a better time. I want Mr. Naumann to really put the numbers together, because you know quite well that, yeah, if you look into doing a cut for integration just like this without giving the schools any opportunity to transition and to do a drastic cut for any district is devastating, number one. And we're doing that with integration funding to St. Paul, to Minneapolis, and Duluth. But then you are also delinking the cross-subsidies for special ed and formulas that really are important to Minneapolis because of the high concentration of poverty. By doing that, perhaps you don't see the devastation and the limitation that you impose in districts like Minneapolis right now. But over time, this is pretty drastic. And I would like to have that presentation, because it's not as simple as you make it sound. It's not as simple when you really talk about the number of children that live in poverty in my district and the number of children with disabilities that actually come from every single district around this table. They come to Minneapolis because we have good teachers and because we have services. They move to Minneapolis. We have a large number of people with disabilities, children with disabilities in our district. By proposing this disconnection in growth, you're limiting our ability to serve these children. And I think this is pretty devastating for our district, and you know that.
Senator Torres-Ray, that the limitation of the growth, you're correct, it isn't leaving it on automatic pilot. But the integration revenue, we didn't cut it cold turkey. There's a whole year of it continuing with the challenge that the next year it is going to be distributed with emphasis on the change that I thought we were purporting to achieve with the additional revenues that go to our schools for compensatory for other kinds of things. Is there improvement? Not, and I didn't make it just on proficiency in one test, but also the growth that in the progress being made toward it. So I've been impressed with some of the things that I've heard, that there are programs that are put in place. They should be starting to take effect and drive that incentive aid. And the more that we can pay out in that, the better I would like it. So there is not an intent to try to do damage. We'll keep talking about this, but I think it's a direction that needs to get on the table and be seriously considered. So, but I thank you for your input, and we'll keep that dialogue going.
Thank you,
Senator Nino. Senator DeKreif, I think. Okay, Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question for the commissioner. Commissioner, I didn't hear you say these words, but I heard this message. I just want to make sure if I heard correctly or not. It sounded to me, the message I heard basically was that if this bill, as it's written today, were to get to the governor, that it would be vetoed. Is that, did I hear the wrong message?
The governor and I have serious concerns with this bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to just ask the commissioner, in the area of basing the assessments, that whole assessment area, and I believe there's several proposals that have been on the table. One of the concerns that I have and this is a little bit from experience, but I've never really seen a really successful performance pay system. Sooner or later, it just kind of gets back to a certain level of subjectivity. And I realize that we can test students and on a certain amount of their growth, but how do you see that developing? I think that's one area that we, I think the governor's interested in. I think Education Minnesota has talked about it. There's language here in the bill on it. How do you see that coming together, if you do?
Madam Chair?
Commissioner?
Senator Stumpf. I just got a report in my inbox just a few days ago from some researchers at the Carlson School of Business and the University of Minnesota on QComp. And I think you could ask any teacher if performance pay is their number one motivator, and they would tell you no. I think teachers would tell you their motivators are a good principal that supports them, good curriculum, and time with other teachers to plan and do the best that they can for kids. I think that's what teachers would tell you. I've never been motivated by more money, quite honestly, and I don't think teachers are money motivated. I think they're motivated by the success of their children. So I think that what we need are fair assessments of teachers that include student outcomes. I heard Ed Minnesota say, yes, we want to include student outcomes. 50% is just too much. If we want teachers to teach to the test, then they'll teach to the test. But what we want is teachers to get creative with our children and to grow their creative thought and problem solving so that they can be matched with the skill sets of the 21st century. And so I see us, we capped QComp because we wanted to study more about professional development. Like you believe, Senator Stumpf, every teacher needs to get the best professional development, absolutely. And the governor and I agree that we need to find solutions to finding the best professional development, and we'd like to see creating networks. That's why we put together the governor's rewarding excellence and innovation, because we believe we could find the bright spots out there and get teachers sharing their best practice with each other. And we knew that teachers needed dollars to be able to do that, and that's why we did it that way. We didn't want to focus solely on third grade performance and give rewards out to kids who are already scoring proficient in third grade reading. What we wanted to do is have a K-12 initiative that rewards all schools across the state for the great achievements that teachers are having with kids. And so part of that incentive was really about them to understand their own practice as well as to share their best practice and create these networks. That's what's motivating for teachers. And so having been a teacher of 20 years and a principal and a superintendent, I can speak directly to this because I've worked alongside great teachers. And I think we need to stop believing that putting a carrot out for them or sticking them with NCLB is going to inspire them to want to change and do best by kids. And so I just share that with you. I think the evaluation bill that Representative Breinhardt has introduced is a fair proposal, and I believe we may have some introduction in the Senate. I think we ought to give that some thought.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Dr. Melcher, as well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question of them?
If it just takes a minute. We have about 10 more people that we need.
Madam Chair,
Senator Steven.
I wanted to ask Commissioner Castillas about the special ed, perhaps Dr. Melcher, about the special ed provision. And again, I hate to take up committee time, but I think as someone that's new to the committee, it's important to understand.
Absolutely.
Special ed cap provision. So I was wondering if, and I appreciate your comments, Commissioner, on special education, especially as it relates to larger urban districts, but I also think that this is worthy of discussion for the rest of our school districts. I know that some of the districts I represent have a really large cross-subsidy of their special ed funding that goes to cross-subsidized general funding, and I'm wondering what the impact of this provision will do to that cross-subsidy and whether it will increase property taxes over time, or I don't think there's any mandate relief of special ed services in this. So what's the long-term impact of this if this would become law?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Senator Sieben, I'm going to let Tom speak directly to that, Dr. Melcher. However, I do know as a former superintendent that the cross-subsidy is great, and most parents don't understand what that really means. And what it means is that you have special ed mandates, and there's a cost to educating special ed students. And this is in every school district in Minnesota. And so everybody will feel the impact of this cut. So you have the cost to educate students, and usually that's greater than what you can afford and what you're given dollars to do. And then we cover that with general ed costs. Well, what that then means is that we cut other programs to cover that cost, because the special ed students were mandated to do that, and we should do that. That's the right thing to do. So this creates a burden on the general ed funding for all students in the general population as well as for our special ed students. And I'll let Dr. Melcher talk specifically about this as well as the pullback of the special ed excess levy.
So, Dr. Melcher, you know, help me understand, too, as well as Senator Sieben, because we didn't take the money out of education. We put it on the formula, and it's going right back out to it. So, I mean, we'll have a cross-subsidy before. We'll have a continue to have a cross-subsidy unless there's an infusion of new revenue from the federal government. But it's still there.
Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, my name is Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Under current law, the special education funding is scheduled to increase by 4.6% per year, and the excess cost aid is scheduled to increase by 2% per year. Cost of special education has been growing by about 4% a year the last couple of years. So the current funding mechanism is covering the growth, and we've had a decrease in some of the cost escalation in the last few years, I think because of the economy, and salary settlements are down. So essentially right now we are kind of keeping even with the cost of special education. Cross subsidies are not increasing under current law. They're actually going down a little bit in the current biennium because the 4.6% is a little faster, a little more inflation than what the actual cost growth is projected to be over the next 2 years. The dollar value of the inflation that is being taken out in this bill is about $94 million in the current biennium and about $265 million in the next 2 years. So as a result, there will be less categorical funding for special education programs, and those dollars are then turned around and reinvested in the general education formula, which goes out on a uniform basis to all schools and students across the state. So I think the net effect is that special education funding is targeted more to school districts that have high concentrations of special education students and higher costs, where general education funding is uniform across the state. So there's some net redistribution that occurs if you take X number of dollars out of special education and put it into general education. You will see some net reductions in Minneapolis and St. Paul, where they have relatively high special education costs, and some net increases in other school districts that have lower special education costs. I think currently the cross subsidy, or the amount of general education money that comes out of the general education formula to cover special education costs, is in the neighborhood of $500 per student in most school districts across the state, and I want to say $800 or $900 per student in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So as you reduce the dollars, it has a larger impact in terms of dollars per student on Minneapolis or St. Paul. I'm not sure about the percentage of the budget, but it would be there would be some net redistribution. That's probably where a portion of that $250 or so that you show in the second year of the biennium is coming from. We haven't calculated the net effect on Minneapolis and St. Paul or other districts. Certainly, it's just a redistribution among schools in the state.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Sieben, for bringing it up. It triggered a one thought I was wondering about. I believe, Commissioner Caselius, you
speculated the proposal would increase property taxes, and perhaps it was in the context of special ed impact, but Dr. Melchert, could you comment further on the impact on property taxes for the proposal?
Dr. Melchert.
Madam Chair and Senator Weger, I know in Mr. Nauman's runs that there's a small net decrease in property taxes that primarily related to the integration levy being eliminated. So that's the direct impact of the bill would be to eliminate the integration levy. There's an increase in the career tech levy that's smaller, so there's a net decrease in levies in the bill. I believe what the commissioner was referring to was that overall the net effect of the bill is a spending reduction in terms of comparison with current law. There are fewer dollars overall that are going to schools than would occur under current law because of some elimination of some of the inflation. I don't think quite all of the dollars are put back in. There's some net reduction in overall spending compared to current law in the bill as it's structured now. I'm not sure of the exact amount. I think it's somewhere $20 to $30 million reduction, which is not a big percentage factor, but there is a reduction. And I think anytime there is a reduction on the state aid side of a budget, there's some pressure on property taxes. And for school districts, the only way that could occur would be through voter-approved referendum. So there would be some additional pressure on school districts to hold voter-approved referendums as a result of the kind of the overall aggregate impact of the bill being a slight decrease in the absolute level of funding for schools. And then that affects different districts differently depending on what kind of redistribution occurs in the bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Cecile Rattel, still here? Or Scott Kronquist? Cecile is here. Rattel?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cecilia Rattel with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And, you know, we're here representing businesses, and the reason we get so involved in education is because many of our businesses are very concerned with their future workforce. And as you guys have all heard multiple times this year already, the three things that are happening right now in the state of Minnesota that we see, you know, in the very near future are this persistent achievement gap, the populations that are growing in Minnesota being on, you know, the lower end of the achievement gap, and the 70% of jobs in Minnesota by 2018 that are going to require some post-secondary training. You know, you put those together, and then we get a bill like this, and we get really excited because there are some very exciting and positive aspects of this bill. And just to kind of try to go through them as quick as possible, one of the things that we really appreciate in this bill is the focus on literacy. We know that students not reading by the time they leave third grade are likely going to have a very difficult time graduating from high school. The funding of the Reading Corps, which is a wonderful program, we like that a lot. And from the video that we watched yesterday and from my own personal experience going through the teaching program, when teachers don't know how to teach the reading that they're supposed to be teaching, it's very difficult for them to be able to teach their students. So giving them that kind of, you know, carrot to get them to go through the program, I think, is an excellent idea. As far as, you know, we know that there's no more important in-school factor than teachers. And having provisions in the bill that it cover the Rising Star provision and requiring them to pass their basic skills test before they get in front of our kids, again, we were very happy to see. And in closing, one thing that we would really like you guys to continue to talk about and encourage you to add into the bill is getting rid of the last in, first out proposals, which, you know, it doesn't allow us to protect our most effective teachers. And in budget times like these, we cannot afford to have ineffective teachers in the classroom. And also, you know, we would love to see a more diverse teaching corps. And when you're always, you know, eliminating the teachers that are newest into the classroom, that's also a very difficult thing to have happen. So with that, I appreciate all of your time and all your hard work in putting this together, and I look forward to working with you more in the future.
Mr. Tell, did you say that it's not in there? Because we do have a provision that deals with the layoff option?
It allows for superintendents to protect the teachers that are in the same category, but it still keeps in the requirement of last in and first out.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Kronquist.
Screwed up because it was supposed to be.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And I'll try to be brief and not repeat a lot of what you've heard already, Madam Chair and members. I'd like to start off by specifically thanking you, Madam Chair, and all the members who advocated successfully for the target that you have. It was no small accomplishment. We understand that in the current budget environment. And so we are just very hopeful that you will maintain that target as you move through the process. We understand there's a lot of twists and turns to go, but it really is critical that you hang on to that target you have to try to protect our public schools to the greatest extent possible. Also want to thank you for the mandate relief that's in the bill. There are some key pieces of mandate relief, the maintenance of effort requirement, the staff development, the flexibility with fund transfers, and repealing the January 15th penalty, all very key pieces that would provide some great flexibility and relief for our school districts during these difficult times. And then just to quickly highlight a couple areas, and then ones that you've already heard about that we do have concerns about. One is the special education, and it's Mr. Melcher just explained it far better than I can. But there are some redistributional effects, and the reality is that the districts that tend to get the hardest are the metropolitan districts, not just the two urban centers, but metro districts in general, and your regional centers, the St. Clouds of the world, tend to have the higher education, special education costs. So we do have concerns about that, and it's been an ongoing struggle. You know that in 2007, this committee really led the way in trying to attack that special ed cross subsidy and start paying that down. And, you know, the unfortunate reality is we're moving right back away and having real high special ed cross subsidies that have a real major impact on our budgets. And I won't repeat, but I just do want to add concern with the integration revenue reductions that you've, the elimination, actually, that you heard about. The only thing I'll add to that is the discussion tends to focus sometimes on the impact on students of color, and we would urge you to also think about, though, the impact on our white students. We think that it is critical that we have integrated learning environments for all students, including our white majority students. I think if you talk to the business community, they'll tell you that what they're looking for is not only students that excel in academics, but those that have worked collaboratively, have worked and have an ability to work with a diverse student body or diverse cultures. And that's going to be essential in the world we live in today. So I will leave it at that, Madam Chair. Thank you for your hard work, and we look forward to continuing to work with all of you members.
Thank you. Elaine Keefe and Jim Bartholomew.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I did tell Mr. Marcus that I was going to be up here wearing three hats. I'll go as quickly as possible.
Thank you.
My name is Elaine Keefe, and first of all, I'm representing the Coalition for Children with Disabilities, which is a coalition of seven organizations working together on special education issues. Very quickly, those seven organizations are the PACER Center, the Minnesota Disability Law Center, the Epilepsy Foundation, the International Dyslexia Association, the Brain Injury Association, the Autism Society, and the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. And as you might imagine, we're very disappointed with the elimination of the special ed growth factor that's in this bill. We had assumed when the promise was made to protect the classroom that that included special ed. And, of course, special ed is the classroom for thousands and thousands of children. We all know that special ed is underfunded. That's why we have a cross-subsidy. And the 4.6% growth factor that was that's eliminated in this bill was put in place to try to contain that cross-subsidy and even to buy it down, as Mr. Melcher just testified, would be the case over the next couple of years. Too often when there are budget discussions at the local level, our families become scapegoats. Special ed kids and general ed kids are pitted against each other when dollars are scarce, and that doesn't help anyone. And so we hope that you reconsider the elimination of the special ed growth factor as you go forward, Madam Chair. Now I'm going to change hats, and on behalf of the Minnesota Library Association, Madam Chair, I'd like to thank you for maintaining current funding for libraries in this bill. I know that literacy is a high priority for you, and so I think this is very fitting. Our libraries are struggling to keep up with the enormous demand for their services, and so we really appreciate your maintaining library funding in this bill. And last, Madam Chair, I want to put on my Minnesota School Nutrition Association hat and thank you for maintaining funding for school nutrition. There was a report over the weekend that we are facing the largest increase in wholesale food prices since 1974. And that means our job of providing appealing and nutritious meals to kids at affordable prices is going to become that much more challenging. And so we thank you for maintaining school nutrition funding in this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And we want to thank you for all your time throughout the session putting this bill together. And as was mentioned early, in a way, this is just the start, but thank you. At the beginning of the session, you heard from my esteemed boss, Charlie Weaver, and Mr. Peter Hutchinson with the Bush Foundation, as well as three principals who've led high-performing, high-poverty schools. All of them reinforced what you already know. Teachers are the most important in-school factor in determining a student's success. Just wanted to highlight a few of the things that your bill does that will help us to maintain and build on the quality of Minnesota's teaching force today. One is starting with the requirement that teacher candidates pass the basic skills test before they enter a teacher prep program or enter a classroom, allowing superintendents to keep their rising stars or less senior teachers during unrequested leave. We also think implementing the temporary freeze in the QEO will help districts avoid unnecessary teacher layoffs. And finally, we think moving towards a system for recognizing teacher effectiveness through compensation is an excellent idea, and we look forward to working with you on that as well. I'll just touch briefly on the literacy incentive revenue. We think that's another fabulous idea, members, and frankly, when first started to read it, I thought we were going to, you were proposing to compensate school districts that had lots of kids that weren't succeeding, and I thought it was wonderful that you were recognizing schools that are succeeding. It's, and I think you heard a little bit from the Florida people, but from others, it's important to recognize success, and it's a great incentive to get more kids there. Also want to just highlight the early high school graduation proposal that's in here. We think that's a great idea for the kids that are prepared and ready to move on from high school. This is a great opportunity. And then finally, just wanted to thank the committee again for your commitment to funding. Was reading over the weekend a synopsis of what the other 49 states are going through in their budgets and how that's impacting K-12. And I think you should be commended for the commitment you've shown, because there are a lot of states in their K-12 systems that are would love to be where you are today. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. There are no questions. Charlie Kite and Bill Reichert.
Hello, I'm Charlie Kite with the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, and you all look like you're staying attentive and with this whole process. It's an endurance race. I'll go very quickly. First of all, and I'm repeating what somebody said just a few minutes ago, we appreciate the fact that in this budget difficulty that you're having, that you, Madam Chair, and others of you, I think, lobbied within your caucuses to see to it that K-12 education was held relatively harmless in this process. And we hope that that can continue, because I'm sure there are pressures coming from all parts of government to try to figure out where this money needs to be used. So stay strong. Couple of pieces about the bill. And we've testified off and on over the last month or so, so I don't want to repeat all that. We appreciate that in the bill there's language about a statewide salary freeze. Now, frankly, we would much rather see the salary freeze be on a voluntary basis, but this is an initiative to maybe have that conversation move forward. We appreciate the number of mandate reductions that have they're going to make it a little bit easier, I think, to run our schools. You have a piece in here on teacher evaluation and tenure. I was reading the House bill and reading this bill, and here's my quick observation. It seems to me that the House bill overprescribes the process, and your language might slightly underprescribe the process. And my hope is that when you come together and have some discussions, that those two pieces might come together to make a really good initiative. I also want to point out that we heard several weeks ago from our Florida colleagues about how they tried to do something at the third grade level. And their plan was sort of the stick, not the carrot. And in this bill, you've actually got some carrots that I think are going to help us at that third and fourth grade level with reading. The reading instructor stipend makes good sense. And also the grade 3 proficiency on the literacy instruction and then the grade 4 growth. That's kind of a carrot to try to have more of our students do well at that grade level. So we appreciate that. We like the basic formula increases. We understand that as to get some of those additional dollars, you had to take it from someplace. We, just like everybody else, are quite concerned. We're concerned especially about capping the special ed growth because we know that the cost of special education for us to provide it keeps going up. The federal government isn't relieving any mandates. The courts aren't relieving any mandates. And we have to do the job, and it's very costly. And that's a place where I think we're going to have a little bit of a pressure point. So with that, we look forward to seeing how this bill comes through the process, how you blend it together with the House bill. And I just want to thank all of you for the work that you've done so far. Thank you very much.
Mr. Eckert.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'll try and keep this very brief. It's getting late. I'm not representing anyone. I'm a private taxpaying citizen. The only ones I represent are my friends and neighbors who also have concerns that couldn't take the day off to come down here today and testify. I would dare say I'm probably one of a very few in this room that are not being paid to be here today. We want to thank the committee for their hard work. It's not an easy task. We also want to thank you for not adopting the language of Senate File 331, especially MELF and QRS. So thank you very much for that. I'm a father of three children, but I also spent 12 years on a privately funded school board. And I've seen what works and what doesn't work, and especially in the area of early childhood pre-K. Reading is key, and I want to thank you for making reading a priority in your bill. That is absolutely key. But I've got concerns about early childhood. We're spending in this may or may not be the most accurate number, $400 million a year. That's what my Senator Jeff Michel said. He also said a week ago in hearing that it's not working. It's broken. So there's a concern over how much we're spending there. Education is an investment. It's a very important investment. My wife and I made the decision to invest twice. We paid our taxes, and we paid our tuition to private schools. So it is important to us. One of the areas I have a concern over, and that is this language about full-service school zones. And if I'm reading this right, it sounds as if we're asking our schools to become a service provider for a multiple area of services in our community. And that's not the school's role. That's not the government's role. We've got private charities that can handle that. So, yes.
May I stop you, Mr. Record?
Sure.
That's a specific bill that Senator Harrington had that allows a zone to be created that allows for protection and the safety of the young people. It's not something that is a widespread will be applied around the country. It is a very specific.
I understand it's specific.
Senator Carrington, is that not the case?
That is correct.
Okay. So thank you very much. But again.
And the other thing I'd like to add is the $400 million that's being spent, that is through the sliding fee child care that's in the Health and Human Services bill. That's
Thank
why
you.
That bill went over there, because most of the money for the child care is in the Health and Human Services.
All right, Madam Chair, thank you for clarifying that for me.
Proceed.
So, I'm just going to keep it brief. I'm just going to close it right here because it is getting late. The good news is we missed rush hour traffic. I just have a question. I heard the number of 19,000 on average for, was that St. Paul or Minneapolis schools per pupil?
Minneapolis, it's 20,000 right
20,
now.
20,000. Because I know when I ran for school board in Bloomington, I think we were 14.5 on our number. In the private sector, we educated our children for less than $7,000 a year. Maybe a $10,000 voucher is a good idea. So on that, I want to thank the committee for your indulgence and your time and your hard work.
Thank you very much, Mr. Reichert. Jim Grathwall and Lynn Nordgren from Minneapolis.
Madam Chair, members, Jim Grathwall from the Minneapolis Schools.
Thank you.
I'll be very brief because I think it has all been said. So in quick order, I'd like to, well, first, thank you for your service. The Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. You're all living in interesting times. Thank you for your service, your discussion, and your debate of these issues. I think it's been a great session for those discussions. Thanks for securing a significant target in this very tough, difficult budget time. Thanks for the Safe Schools maintenance of effort, the Safe School set-aside maintenance of effort repeal. Thanks for the January 15th deadline repeal. We support that. I think that literacy aid is an intriguing notion. I was happy to share with you our data on early childhood literacy and actually how our early childhood programs up to grade one were closing the gap. Our latest data is, as of December, our kindergartners, 30% are at the end of year literacy benchmark, and 60% are at the on track for their literacy benchmark. So I think our early childhood investments are paying off significantly. I want to share concerns about a couple things. One is the special education freeze. And when we do that, or de-link compensatory and cap that amount, and we reallocate, and of course, Senator Nelson, keep wanting to call you Carlson. Senator Nelson, we all want to support the Carlin Nelson. We all want to support the formula as well. But when we reallocate, and it's just reminds me of that watch the pea under the shells, and when we take money out of special ed, we know that will continue to grow. If we put that money on the formula, we know that our special ed cross-subsidy will reach over and pull that back. So I empathize with the all districts in the state of Minnesota need more resources to deliver the services they want to do. Finally, I think I'd like to close out. I'm deeply concerned about the Senate approach on integration revenue. When we and I appreciate the one-year window, but I want to make sure we don't have a policy in the state of Minnesota that de facto segregation is all we have left. That's kind of where we are after kind of looking at both the House and the Senate bill. So we think integration is a state value. We think the programs we have, and, you know, magnet programs with transportation focused on achievement and results, I think we've shared some of that data. I think we should continue to work on that. I think we should have a more muscular and comprehensive policy on integration. And I'd like to reiterate Scott Krenquist's comments, which bear repeating, that for me as a parent, what I value as my students went through the kids as students went through the Minneapolis public schools is the value of integration for them and their multicultural education. Happy to answer any questions, and I'm happy to turn it over to Lynn.
Mr. Grathwall, I think desegregation is illegal. We have not that this can't change that, segregation is illegal, not desegregation. Segregation is. So,
Madam Chair, does the bill repeal the rule? And the bill repeals statutory references.
But that still doesn't make segregation legal.
Thank you very much,
Madam Chair.
You know,
Madam Chair, we were listening to a lot of testimony today, but nobody seemed to mention the changes to some of the delinking of sparsity transportation and compensatory was actually not, it was delinked, but it was a different type of a formula. And if you look at the compensatory, I think the way it, at least, you know, from an initial reading, as the state's enrollment goes up, the amount goes down per pupil. And I maybe should ask someone to see if that's correct, that as you have a population growth, that the actual dollar amount, because it's fixed, would become less. Is that right?
It's is a fixed amount.
Madam Chair and members, the way the I apologize, Senator Stump. I was checking an email. We've been going back and forth with finance on a couple of items. So I think your question related specifically to the compensatory freeze.
I was just wondering how that the delinking of there's some delinking that takes place. I don't think all the programs are delinked, but sparsity and sparsity transportation, but on the compensatory, because you have you burn in a dollar figure as that population. Let's say if we gain, we had an influx of immigrants that would qualify for free and reduced, and let's say 100,000 students came next year. The amount that students would receive would go down. Isn't that right?
Madam Chair and Senator Stumpf, I understand the thrust of your question. So the way the compensatory formula under the Senate package would work in future years is initially what's done is the total amount of compensatory, which is about $414 million in fiscal year 11, is divided by the fiscal year 11 pupils. So you generate an allowance, if you will, not dissimilar from the formula allowance, but it's a specific allowance, and it's going to vary by school district based on the amount of compensatory that a school district is receiving in fiscal year 11. That allowance is then carried forward into subsequent years and multiplied times the pupil units in that specific year. So in fiscal year 13, for example, we will multiply the allowance that was generated in 11 times the fiscal year 13 pupil count. Under the scenario that you were portraying, if there is an influx of pupils and the total amount of compensatory revenue is in excess of 414, there is language in the bill that would prorate that back down to 414.
That's what I thought.
But the inverse is also true. That if it's underneath 414, it gets prorated up.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Nelman. And if that 100,000 came, we might be in a pickle because we'd owe the basic formula for every one of those students. So if hope and pray that the forecast would deliver some more money. So we've got where did I see? Lynn Nordby? Oh, it's Senator DeCripe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grothwell, I have a question for you. I represent a district, Senate District 25, and there's a number of smaller schools down that area. I think what this bill does in some of the integration, I know you've brought up integration. I think what it does is it exposes the exorbitant amount of money that went to certain school districts in that particular formula, for instance. When I look at the amount of money on the sheet here, for every dollar that goes to a school district in my area, $1.50 goes to the Minneapolis School District. I see a larger district having the ability to do some efficiencies that a smaller school district can't. We have busing too, and busing goes long distances in the country, picking up kids throughout the countryside. Do you see at all that this integration formula may have at one time given a disproportionate amount of money to the metro schools where it didn't, where the funding stayed flat in the rural areas or in greater Minnesota, or do you just not agree with that at all? Do you think that that what we're trying to do? I think in part what we're trying to do is we're trying to right the ship a little bit here. Because our schools, like I said, we're getting a dollar to your $1.50. That's a lot of money. That's millions and millions of dollars. And I just look at it from my perspective that you have an awful lot of money, you have an awful lot of opportunities for efficiencies, and I agree that downsizing is difficult, but I've been in school districts that have had to downsize because of declining enrollment, and it's difficult. It's very difficult. But sometimes learning how to live on a little less is something that we all have to do. I have to do it from time to time. I've had to do it throughout my life. How would you respond to that?
Madam Chair and Senator.
Mr. Grethel.
every district has its own specific challenges. I agree. We could speak to that there's a reason Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth had statutory different amounts. I don't want to take too much committee time, but the Minneapolis Public Schools was the district that was sued in 72, the settlement, court supervision, taking that plan, all districts, all school sites were involved, all school sites were required to meet targets over 11 years of court supervision, and then under the rule. So there's a specific history. I think I provided that to the committee when my superintendent came to testify. In terms of other areas, we've had a 30 or 40 year tradition applying additional revenue where there's additional need. Let's parse it. In special ed, we all recognize we can have a $30,000, $60,000, or $90,000 autistic student. We provide resources for that student. It's a civil right. It's the law, and we're happy to do that. For the English language learner, to pick up a language, you need additional support. And when there's 90 languages you're working with, you need additional support for that. When it's students in poverty, poverty isn't causal, but it's highly correlative with a difficulty in academic achievement. So compensatory revenue as a formula is designed to address that. Now, we're triple winners under the three formulas I've mentioned. I understand people want the revenue. I want to focus people that the revenue is associated with responsibility. And as much as people often come and say, I want additional revenue, I don't have a lot of people in my conversations talk to me and say, I really want a student school site that has 90% students in poverty, 90% students of color, and 25% ELL, English language learners. So I think simplicity and complexity. A fair and equitable system is going to be complex. I think we have that. A simple taxation system, for example, is the sheriff of Nottingham shows up and carries off anything that's not nailed down. It's not equitable. So all of our districts, and I think our K-12 finance system does a very good job. I would not begrudge any district or any member around the table from arguing they need more resources. I think the issue is it's the waterhole analogy that let me go back just to the integration program. As we expanded that out, I think there's cliffs in that formula. The MNSIC task force gave you a good set of recommendations that you could follow, the Minnesota School Integration Council task force. Those could be picked up. I think it's we have more poverty, more students of color, more need to integrate throughout this state. I think that's a good thing. And I think we should apply resources to that. Madam Chair, Senator, have I provided you with an answer? Or should we meet offline and have a conversation?
We could have a conversation at another time.
All right. Thanks,
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief comment. I think there's something that's been missing in this discussion, though. And it's not just about more resources. I think what we all should agree upon in this room is we need more results, and we need to be focused on what's best for kids. And I guess that's the overarching theme that I will be looking for.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I agree.
Thank you, Mr. Grethwell. Ms. Norgren.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Sorry to keep you waiting
that's
so long.
That's quite all right. It's been very interesting. My name is Lynn Nordgren. I've been a teacher and a resident on the north side of Minneapolis for 35 years, and I am currently serving over the last 2 years as president of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. I want to echo the sentiments of Mr. Kite and Mr. Grathwall. I agree with much of what they put forward, but I also want to say thank you for your leadership in these challenging times. I know what that feels like. That said, I am speaking against this bill in general, and I'm going to tell you why. Last week, I was able and fortunate to attend the first international education conference ever held in New York, where countries from all over the world came with their education ministers, with the presidents of the country, the unions, presidents of the union from countries, and with Arne Duncan, Randy Weingarten from the American Federation of Teachers, and Dennis Van Roekel from the NEA, and many other very distinguished people in the world of education. It was thrilling. And what we talked about for 3 days was closing the gap, which exists everywhere, and how to raise the bar in education overall. And what I would like to say to you is that much of what we learned is the conceptual opposite of what this bill has in it. So I'm worried. I'd like to very quickly share with you what some of those concepts are. And this work, because data, I believe, is also important, Andreas, it's A-N-D-R-E-A-S, Schleicher, S-C-H-L-E-I-C-H-E-R. You can Google his name, and there's just tons of information for you there. He has studied 39 countries from across the world based on the PISA work, the PISA study, and most of those countries have surpassed us over the last 10 years in graduation rates, in test scores, in children going on, students going on to college, and here's how they did it. They have high quality early education for all from birth to five. They have adequate nutrition and health care for all children. And as someone who lives in the Hawthorne neighborhood and has taught in schools where there's 60, 70, 80, sometimes 90% poverty, I can tell you that thousands of Minneapolis children go without hundreds of meals every year of their life. There is something very wrong with that. Not just in America, but for that to be happening in Minnesota is not okay. You can't have proper body and brain development without proper nutrition or health care. The third thing is teacher pre-service education is much longer. It's more rigorous. There are residency programs. There's 2 to 3 years of mentoring. You must have your master's degree. It is hugely rigorous, and not many get in. Out of 6,000 that apply in Finland, 1,000 are accepted. And so it's not a short and sweet. It's much like trying to become a doctor. Teacher evaluation. And I have to tell you, that's something that I was involved in very deeply for 15 years in the school district. In the other countries, it is not a gotcha. It is not an observation only. Sometimes, and often by, in our case, people who have never taught the subject before and know nothing about it. So it's not tied to observations only. It's not tied to test scores, and it's not tied to pay. What it is that it is supportive, meaningful, differentiated, and not just based on one thing. And just as a side note, I would like you to know, because for some reason this is so hard for me to get this out, and I've been talking about it for over a decade, I'm going to tell you so you hear it. We have developed in Minneapolis through our union, and it's in our contract, something called the professional development process. It is peer assistance and review. Of that, we have created achievement of tenure, which is a very rigorous 3-year process. You are just not observed. You have many other things you must do to become tenured. We want to make sure that you're going to be good for kids. We also have standards of effective instruction in our contract. We've had those for 15 years. They match many of the standards that are now being produced out nationally. And we have something called the PSP, professional support process. Through that process, if there are teachers that are struggling, we say we're going to help you first. We're going to bring in some mentoring and coaching. We're going to have a team. Principals on the team. Other colleagues are on the team. We're going to get focused. We're going to meet with you more. We're going to give you the supplies and resources you may be missing. We're going to find out what's working and what's not working. And out of those 1,200 teachers that have been on a PSP, 700 are now better. They were able to improve. And 500 no longer work in Minneapolis Public Schools. So when you read the paper and it says that we have not gotten rid of a teacher, it is simply not true. And on a weekly basis, we also have teachers we just flat out fire for misconduct. So it isn't true that you can't get rid of a teacher. What else has worked in the other countries? They have more support for the schools that have high levels of poverty, like lower class size. As someone who taught 44 fourth graders at one time and then taught through Public School Academy 14 fourth graders, I can tell you I closed the gap. And I was able to help. I know for a fact that all of my students, except one, graduated from high school, and that one had some mental health issues. And they all lived in poverty. So I know that a lower class size and supporting children in poverty helps. Strong partnerships between unions and government agencies and school districts was, everyone sort of looked at us funny, like, well, what do you mean you can't make that work? When we asked Finland, who has the highest test scores, they said, well, we've been doing collaboration for 150 years. We really can't tell you how it got started, but it's a really good thing. And so we want to keep collective bargaining going because it's the only way teachers have a voice. We do not set the budget. We don't pick the curriculum. We don't pick our leaders. We don't even get to pick the room we're in. It's the only way we have a voice to stand up for we know what is right or wrong. And I'm going to tell you something. This is not very Minnesota-like of me, but I'm going to tell you that I am very proud of the fact that I was an excellent teacher and I closed the gap. And one of the ways with every one of my students, they tested out of special ed unless they had special, really special ed needs. But I did that by mostly doing the opposite of what I was asked to do. And most of the top teachers, they will tell you the same thing. The other thing about collective bargaining is that the top states that in performance of test scores have collective bargaining, and the bottom five states do not. The other thing that they said is more autonomy for schools, fewer mandates, and less bureaucracy. This does not mean a free-for-all. I do not believe in a free-for-all. But it allows teachers to choose their best curriculum, much like I did, and the strategies that will work. But they also give support for teachers, adequate time, professional development, and resources. Right now, our teachers in Minneapolis work 10 to 14 hours a day and weekends and most of their vacation time and summers. I've never had a summer off in 35 years because I was busy preparing and learning. And so what we know is that we contribute about $60 million a year in unpaid overtime. And over the course of our career, we take $20,000 out of our own pockets to buy resources. Finally, on that same note, when it comes to time, out of 2,400 teachers in a survey, 81% of them in Minneapolis said they do not have enough time to get ready for the next day. And as you know, Senator Olson, you have to be ready for the next day. And so no matter what you do, but really when you have 10-year-olds in front of you, you have to be ready. They take everything home to do it at night. In the other countries, they don't do that. They provide time during the day for teachers to be able to collaborate and work together. They have better use of data. They do not rely on just a single test score. It is that everyday data that you can take a look at and respond to and change your practice. They do coalition building with families. They don't hand them a check and say, good luck finding another school. They bring them into the school. They go out to the communities, and they build coalitions with the families. And then they finally also have collaboration time built into the workday where teachers can come together and learn from one another. And I don't see that anywhere. We've been asking for that for years. So I'm worried about what's being proposed. I feel like it will take us backwards, even though there are some things in it I think are good. We just simply can't afford it. I wore a pin today that is a symbol of an ancient clan. And in this pin, people are working together. And we know that one for all and all for one has really been the Minnesota model for a long time, and a famous quote of we all do better when we all do better. And I feel like this bill will not help us do better at this point in time. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Ms. Nordgren. You operate with the same philosophy that my mother did, and she was an extremely effective teacher.
Yeah, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rieger.
That was just great presentation.
Thank you.
Thanks for
most
sharing.
Most of us are mentally exhausted, but you just really charged
thank
stuff
you.
Again.
Thank I was
you.
A little worried. Excuse me, Chair. I was a little worried. You might not listen, but you did. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Brandon Royce. Still here? Okay. Not. I think we have reached our saturation point. And we will be meeting tomorrow to further consider this bill and take some action tomorrow. So, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam. Just one thing, just one treat. I'm just passing out bookmarks for the audience as well and my committee members. This is from the Inside Out, highly successful science partnership with Winona State University, Mayo Clinic researchers, and some of the Rochester Public Schools. The thing you might like about this is all their contact information's on the back if it's something you want to take home to your districts. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If there's no further questions, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
You go to my community.
You're sticking with us this long.
Actually, I'm wrong.
Yeah, I have one at 6.
I know. That's my husband's birthday
today. Hi.
That's Drive. I got to admit.
Oh, hi.
See you, Mr. Harrington.
Yes. We tried to, yes.
All back again?
Yes, and I was connected there. You've got, I don't know, what's the status? Is yours in your bill? In the omnibus? Well, we've got Humps here, so it sounds like that they've, what was the one opinion that... We've underprescribed.
Give me a couple minutes to shut down.
There's room for movement, in other words.